Hello and welcome to WGTC Radio, the official podcast of entertainment website We Got This Covered. I'm Jonathan Lack.
And I'm Sean Chapman.
And we are here to finally talk about The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey.
Hobbit, terrible subtitle.
All right.
So after we've been talking about, you know, The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit for like a month now.
Yeah.
Finally, we get to the part where the reason why we started talking about it in the first place, we can put an end to it.
It's like finally getting to Mount Doom.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going a long way. There's been several obstacles. We're finally there.
But using that metaphor, does that mean that we will now not talk about The Hobbit, just like how Frodo just doesn't chuck the ring into the fire?
That would really disappoint our listeners, I feel. Like, we've drugged them through, like, a whole month of talking about Lord of the Rings. And then if we just didn't talk about it.
Yep.
Well, we're not going to talk about it right at first. I have another couple things to tell you guys about, but then we're going to get into The Hobbit. And it'll be like, if you've ever heard us talk about, you know, like, a new movie release before,
you
know what we're going to do. We're going to talk about it in depth. If you have not seen the movie, wait to listen to this. It's spoilery. Obviously,
super, super spoilery.
Right. I mean, obviously, The Hobbit is, if you know the book, it's you can't really get it spoiled, but there's stuff in this movie that's new, and maybe you don't want to know the order it comes in or anything.
Yeah.
So just see the movie, and then you can listen to this. It's going to be long. We're going to talk about everything in this movie, and it'll be pretty in depth. And, I mean, really quick opinions. Sean, what'd you think?
I thought it was really good. I don't think it was maybe quite as good as the Lord of the Rings movies, but I think I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'm really
excited for the other movies.
Yes, I enjoyed it too. You know, my full review is on We Got This Covered. That's a spoiler-free review if you want to read that. And, you know, I have issues with the movie. There are some structural problems and some things I would point out as flaws that obviously hold it back from coming close to, like, Fellowship of the Ring for me, but it's a very good movie, and it's a very good companion piece to Lord of the Rings. And most importantly, I think it's a great launch pad for the next two films in the trilogy.
Yeah, that's basically exactly how I feel.
So highly recommended. I would recommend seeing it in 2D. Now, if you're interested in 48 frames per second, I think it's probably worth, if you're really interested, maybe go do that. I would recommend making it your second viewing, because it crippled my first viewing of the movie, and I think you probably just want to see the movie as a movie, and then maybe see the other technical stuff.
Yeah, so that's how I did. I watched the 2D version. I have not yet seen the
48
frames. Yeah, the fancy schmancy 48 frames per second 3D.
Yeah, so I recommend the 2D. It looks much prettier that way to me. But in any case, that's our recommendation without spoilers, but we'll obviously go into much greater depth.
I think podcast is done. 3 minutes? That's good. Let's go home.
That's what, like 1% of our usual length?
Yeah. I don't even think it like registers as 1%.
Okay. So in any case, the first thing I actually wanted to tell you guys about is... Okay, well, I'll wait on that. The first thing I want to tell you guys about is some site stuff. We Got This Covered since our last podcast has had some new stuff go up. Including,
it's now in 48 frames per second.
Kind of. We have a whole new redesign.
Yeah.
And site's been completely redesigned. It looks much nicer to me. You know, there are some kinks we're still working out because it's a big redesign. The main reason we did it was under the hood to make the site faster and just work better for everyone. And we hope it does. I think it's definitely faster now, a little less clunky than the old design. So we hope you enjoy that redesign. The best thing for me about it is that it presents text and pictures much better, which is the point of any website like this.
Yeah.
So just reading articles, it's a much nicer sort of typeface and presentation. Pictures look better. We don't have so many page elements. Like on reviews, there isn't that stupid thing we used to have with the different like infos, like here's what's good about the movie and bad, and here's the verdict, and here's all our percentages. Now you just, there's the review, and at the bottom, there's however many stars. We're now doing 5 stars for movies and video games and TV shows. So I recommend checking out the new redesign. And if you go check out the new redesign, there's a bunch of cool shit up. There's my review of The Hobbit, my review of Les Miserables, the musical, which comes out Christmas Day, a couple other reviews like Zero Dark Thirty, which we talked about last week. So there's a bunch of reviews you can read. There is also, and this is very exciting, my top 10 list of 2012. It published last Wednesday on 12/12/12, and it's a cool list, so check it out. It's, you know, it's got some movies on there that aren't out yet that you can read about before sort of my full reviews go up later in the month or next month, depending on when the movies finally come to Denver. So it's a good list. It was a great year for movies. It was hard to whittle it down to 10, but I think it's an article worth reading. And then if you want the flip side of that, there's the 10 worst movies of 2012, which I have not gotten as much hate mail as I expected for that, Sean.
No, really?
Because Prometheus is on it. And you know what happens when I write about Prometheus.
Yeah, you get death threats.
Yeah.
People hate you.
I've not gotten death threats yet, and I'm impressed. But yes, so there's the 10 worst films of 2012 as a compliment. That article's getting significant more readership, which, again, is confusing me as to why I'm not getting death threats.
I don't know.
I feel incomplete.
Maybe maybe the world is finally becoming a little bit more sane and people are coming around to our side on Prometheus.
That'd be good. I want to live in that world.
Yeah,
yeah.
Me too.
In any case, so those two articles are out. And then next week, before the next podcast comes out, I'm going to finish all sort of my retrospective articles of 2012. There will be on Monday the runner-up films from the top 10 list. So it'll be like numbers 30 through number 11. And it'll be much shorter descriptions about each one of those. So you can put those together, and it's sort of a top 30 list for 2012. It was a really good year. I wanted to count all that down. Wednesday will be the top 10 movie moments of 2012. I think that's just like different, like what scenes were really good. For instance, in The Hobbit, you have the Riddles in the Dark scene. That's on that list because it's a great fucking scene.
Yeah. But can this count? Can I make a recommendation that you put in the deleted scene from Prometheus where she says, "Because I'm a human and you're a fucking robot"? Can that be on there somewhere?
Could it be like an honorable mention?
Yeah. Can you put that on there?
I think I'll have to do that. I'll do that for you, Sean. I'll make a note of that. While we're recording. So that sounds like fun. But in any case, that'll be up on Wednesday. That's a fun one. It's sort of, the focus there is to talk about scenes in movies that maybe weren't good enough to make the top 10, but definitely had individual moments that were just phenomenal. So that'll be a good list.
Like, I'm a human, you're a fucking robot.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the purpose of that list, I think.
Yep.
And then Friday will be the final sort of big 2012 retrospective article. That will be the top 10 film scores of 2012, which will also obviously include The Hobbit on it, because Howard Shore, he's the man.
Yep.
So in any case, those are sort of all the end-of-year articles coming out. And then once we get closer to Christmas, I've got a bunch of new reviews coming out. We'll have my reviews of Judd Apatow's new movie, This Is 40, Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained, which I believe is the best film of 2012. Lots of other cool stuff. And we will talk about all that on the podcast next week, too. I will go through my top 10, my bottom 10. Sean will have some year-end retrospective for gaming and stuff. Next week will be kind of a freewheeling show. I think we'll do some of that stuff structured for like maybe the first 45 minutes, and then we'll probably just talk about shit from the year.
That's kind of just is how it always seems to go. We're structured for a little bit, then we're just like, whatever.
Yeah. And that'll be our last show of 2012, and we'll come back in 2013. So, all that business out of the way. I wanted to mention really quick, because it's pertinent to this podcast, because our favorite stand-up comedian, Sean, is
Louis C.K.
Oh, absolutely. Tell us why Louis C.K. is awesome.
Because he's awesome. He's really fucking funny.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
He's one of those comedians who I just think sort of our worldview is definitely shared by him. And
yeah.
So we really
definitely.
Connects. Mm-hmm. And we love his TV show and all his stand-up. And I got to see him last night. He was in Denver at the Wells Fargo Theater. And he was awesome. I was cool because I got to be really close. I was in like the 9th row overall on the floor. So that was fun because he's a very visual comic. He does a lot with his face and moves around, so
yeah.
It's definitely cool to see him up close. You also realize when you see him up close, he really dresses down. He's like, you would think it's kind of an exaggeration on the show. No, he just pants and a t-shirt.
Yeah, no, that's the black t-shirt.
Yeah.
It's a tradition.
Yeah, and it works perfectly for him.
Yeah.
So, love it. But I wanted to talk about it because this was a damn good hour of stand-up, and if you know anything about Louis C.K., you know he does the George Carlin thing where he dumps every hour of stand-up he does at the end of the year and always comes out with a new hour of stand-up that he does on the next tour.
Yeah.
And he's very rigorous about that. He does that, and I definitely respect him for that because that's got to be tough.
Yeah.
Because it's always really good, all his material, and to come up with that much good new material every year is, I couldn't do it.
Yeah, that's why he's like one of the best comics out there right now.
Absolutely.
Not a lot of people can do that.
No. But in any case, this new hour, I've seen all of his sort of stand-up hours, I would say, probably going back to like 2007 when he started putting them out on DVD.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this may be his best hour yet. And so if he's coming to your city, obviously recommend him. And a special from this tour will be airing on HBO, and then it'll come out on his website under the like $5 no DRM deal, which was really awesome he did for Live at the Beacon Theater. So it's a great hour. It's a little more freewheeling than his other hours. Like there's less sort of connections between the material. So it feels a little more casual, but I kind of like that because it allows him to build just these individual bits that are just masterpieces. Like sort of the first sort of major main bit of the night, he did this whole thing about how he's got a new apartment complex. It's sort of more ritzy because he's made some money, obviously.
Mm.
And he's in the courtyard and this rich guy's looking at him and he thinks, oh, the rich guy's going to come over here and tell me off because he thinks I don't live here. So he lets the rich guy come over and then just fucks with him and pretends he doesn't really live there. And it goes, it's this whole story. It's very funny. You can kind of see where it's going. And I'm laughing at it. And I'm thinking, well, this is really good. It's not like the best thing he's ever done, but it's good. And then he tells us that none of that actually happened. and that he was just imagining it. And then he goes into this really clever deconstruction of, like, how we build stories like that in our heads, like, when we see something, and how a prejudice just spirals out of control like that. And that, to me, defines Louis C.K.
Yeah.
He has really funny humor, and he'll start just in a very sort of simple, banal place of funny, and then start analyzing it and getting deeper, and kind of philosophical. And it's cynically philosophical, but it's really kind of poignant.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
He uses his comedy to sort of speak to you.
Yes. And he had this great sort of semi-motivational speech in the middle of the show where he talked about how the keys to self-improvement are regret and self-hate. And that was great. Just lots and lots of good stuff. He made jokes about the end of The Grapes of Wrath and the breastfeeding scene, which... That's great comic material. Why do we not hear that more in stand-up acts?
I don't know. I think referencing, you know, 1940s classic literature is not necessarily, like, the easiest thing.
No.
For an audience. It's not necessarily the audience pleaser.
No, but it's...
Wait till you hear my Great Gatsby jokes.
In any case, Louis C.K., really great. Just wanted to mention that because he's definitely one of our favorite sort of artistic voices out there today.
Yeah.
And it was a good show, and recommend it. Anything going on in your life, Sean?
Not that much. I finished Far Cry 3, which...
Now, you had some reservations last time you played it. You wanted to see how it ended before you sort of judged the story. What do you think?
It did suck. I definitely kind of suspected that the story was not going to fulfill its potential, and it really didn't. And that was kind of disappointing. And after I put down the game, I was like... Because they did this really dumb thing. This isn't going to spoil anything. Where they do... Like, it's a very video gamey thing where you have two different endings, but it's like how you access the two different endings. It's actually very similar to Mass Effect 3 in a weird way, where you just, like, at the very end, there's this choice to just, like, press left trigger to do something or right trigger to do something, and that's how it ends. And it's, you know, nothing else in the game is like that. It's a very dumb video gamey type of attitude that we're suddenly going to put in this very arbitrary player choice that has no significance at the very end of the game when something like that has never popped up again in the game anywhere else. And so I picked one of the endings. And also, of course, this is one of those games, fucking Ubisoft with their saving policies where, you know, you can't archive saves, so I couldn't go back and just, like, reload my save and do that because it's the same. It's like you have one save and just quick saves and auto saves over that. So luckily didn't fuck me over this time that much. But so I watched the other ending on YouTube, and they both are equally awful.
Okay.
And both just don't know what... It's like the game doesn't know what it's really about, which is really disappointing because the first, like, third or so of the game is really compelling and really interesting first-person shooter storytelling in a way that most first-person shooters don't try to tackle. But I would say, even though the story is ultimately really disappointing, I'd say the first third is really great sort of on its own. It is... sort of shows you where you can go with first-person shooters, storytelling, and then also the gameplay is super fun, so I still highly recommend it, but, you know, the story has some flaws that are ultimately disappointing. But
so has it kind of soured you on the game a little, or are you...
Yeah, I mean, not that much, because I kind of knew that was happening. I kind of saw the signs after they got rid of the... Because they get rid of the first antagonist, like, halfway through the story and represent, like, bring you a new antagonist. And they get rid of both of those antagonists in the same really awful way, too. But there's overuse of quick time events and boss fights that is really also just kind of disappointing. But
that's too bad. I still want to play it sometime.
Yeah, no, I should just say all these complaints are only about the story. And that game, what's really great about that game is the world and what goes on in the world and just inhabiting that world. And, you know, taking out the outposts and stuff like that is so much fun that's what's... really great about that game, and the story being not awesome for the sort of the second half doesn't diminish that in any way, really.
Right.
Which is kind of remarkable because I'm really into storytelling in video games, and I was really hoping that side would hold it up more, but it's kind of interesting to me that even though the story kind of sucked ultimately, I don't care. And usually I would care a lot more about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I should also say the multiplayer is too super forgettable, but... Like, I, like, tried two rounds of it, and it's like, this is Call of Duty multiplayer. I don't know why they put it in here. And it's like, this is like, the single player is so much more compelling, but...
I didn't even know, because we talked about it, and I saw you play it, and I didn't even know it had multiplayer until I watched the IGN review, and they said the same thing you did. They, like, spent 2 seconds on it, and it was like, it's boring. And then they just stopped talking.
Yeah, it's basically, it's just exactly like Call of Duty multiplayer, so it's like, whatever. I was like, I should give it a shot. I was like, yeah, I don't really need to give it much of a shot. 2 rounds is enough.
All right. So anything else to talk about before we jump into our discussion of The Hobbit?
No, I want to talk about The Hobbit now.
All right, I'm excited to talk about The Hobbit because Lots to talk about here.
Yeah.
Good movie. First thing I want to mention, because I want to keep this discussion just on the movie, so we're going to talk about the technical side really quick. I saw the movie at the press screening. Warner showed it to us in 48 frames per second, 3D, and that's how I saw it the first time. And if you haven't sort of heard all the ballyhoo about this...
Ballyhoo?
Yeah, film is normally shot in 24 frames per second, so every second of film you're seeing is 24 separate pictures, and that's what creates movement in film. Higher frame rates have been talked about for a long time. The Hobbit is the first major motion picture to shoot with a higher frame rate. It's 48 frames per second, and also in 3D. So it's all shot digitally, and sort of the theory behind 48 frames per second is that because it's more visual data and it's moving at a faster rate, it will remove some of the visual flaws, you could say, in normal projection, which is that... The
biggest is motion blur.
Yeah, motion blur, strobing... things like that, and it should be a clearer picture. It's sort of like people compare it to the jump from... It'd be like high def to super high def or something.
Yeah.
And so that's the theory. And obviously it's been very contentious since the movie came out. Some people love it, some people hate it. My brother, for instance, Thomas, he went to see it with me, and he loved it. He thought it looked amazing, clearest experience he's ever seen. He said it was exactly how Peter Jackson described it in like interviews and stuff, and it worked really well for him, made the 3D deeper, all those things. And I've heard a lot of people say that, and I trust their opinion. If that's what they saw, that's what they saw. I despised the 48 frames per second, and if press screenings for future Hobbit movies are in that format, I may have to bow out of reviewing them at a press screening, because it really made it tough to enjoy the movie. For me, what the 48 frames did, for one, movement just looked all wrong. People were like darting around like they were in a Benny Hill skit. Or just like they would dart from one end of the room to the other, like they're the Roadrunner. It's very odd movement, and it never quite clears out right. Everything starts looking very sort of cheap and chintzy, like a TV movie. Like the lighting doesn't look good, the makeup doesn't look good. You can tell where beards have been like glued on. So Gandalf's beard, you can tell it's not his real beard, and that's really sad because that's his beard, man.
Yeah.
That's where he gets his power.
It's like when we were talking about the Hobbit animated movie. It's like the beard and Gandalf are one.
They should, yeah. And so that looked wrong. Like, all the makeup looked bad. All the, like, when you go into, like, Erebor and you see all the gold, it's like, oh my god, that's not, this looks like Chuck E. Cheese coins. It's just the whole movie, it did not look good. The last hour where it's underground, like the Riddles in the Dark scene, for instance, that looked okay. Dark scenes were handled better than light scenes, but man... New Zealand looked like crap, and I don't know how you make New Zealand look like crap, but this just did not look right. Camera pans moved way too fast, and they kind of shuddered for me. And yeah, the 3D, I should mention, I don't even remember there being 3D in it. There was depth, I guess, but nothing noticeable in that format for me. And so my sort of working theory on that is that I have eye problems. I wear glasses. I have astigmatism like a lot of people do, so I wear glasses. And 3D has never been great for me because I think it's probably because my eyes are a little different than the norm they intend 3D for.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, when I watch 3D movies, there's often a lot of sort of blur to it. When I play the Nintendo 3DS, I always have to kind of fiddle with the 3D knob to make it look right. The 3DS is much better than movies for me, but still, I have to fiddle with it to see 3D. And I'm guessing the 48 frames is sort of similar, where it's so much more demanding on your eyes and mind that if your eyes have any sort of defect, I'm guessing it doesn't look as good. And that may be part of the problem. And
I don't know if that's scientifically substantiated anyway.
I just want to
put that out
there. But it holds up for me. Like when I got out of the movie and I said to Thomas, that looked awful, and he said that looked great. We've had that discussion a lot about 3D, and it's sort of interesting where that
I think happens. It's more likely for 3D than it is for 48 frames per second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and here's the other theory, is that if you're more used to 24 frames...
Yeah, it's going to bother you way more.
But at the same time, it just didn't work for me. I mean, this is the thing I have to stress, is that it wasn't just that I didn't like how it looked. I don't think it was working right. Because in some scenes, they moved normally, and then in other scenes, it wasn't, the 48 frames were not melding. It's like I could see in between the frames, as weird as that sounds. And the people who like it have not reported that. And I don't know what the issue is there, but I feel like it's divisive enough, and it's sort of risky enough that I would not see this movie the first time in 48 frames. If you're really interested, maybe experiment with it the second or third time you see it, but it really ruined the movie for me. I just could not get into it. That's the other thing. Effects looked awful. There's more CGI in this movie than in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Yeah, and all of it looked kind of chintzy to me until you got to Gollum, who looked perfect. But they obviously... they know what they're doing with Gollum a little more or whatever, or he's in a more well-lit environment, I don't know, but or more precisely lit, yeah. Whatever it is. The 48 did not look good to me, and if you're really interested, maybe check it out. I guess the other thing is it's different than anything you've ever seen because it doesn't look like film or even digital filmmaking. At its best, it is supposed to just look like real people. Yeah. And when it works, it does, but I don't know what's, to me, interesting about that. Because the entire idea behind photography and behind cinematography is that you're not just capturing real life. You're capturing an artistic representation of real life. You can aim a camera at a beautiful mountain, and you can make your picture look like shit if you're not good at what you're doing. The point of photography is sort of to bring out artistic elements in what you're taking pictures of, or in filmmaking, what you're filming. And sort of this push towards, all right, let's just make it look real. I don't know what the point in that is, totally. Because you could just go see the stage play version of it at that point. I mean, it's sort of an interesting dynamic. I see what Peter Jackson was going for. I see the inspiration. It didn't work for me. And I'm saying it up front because Sean saw it in 2D.
Yeah, I saw it in 2D, normal 24 frames.
Right, and I saw it in 2D a second time and enjoyed the movie so much more the second time I saw it. It's a gorgeous movie. Great cinematography, great effects, great everything about it, right? Visually? Really good.
Well, maybe. Well, okay. We'll talk
about
that.
We have a couple of little issues, but like New Zealand looks great, the sets look good, all that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but in 48, it didn't look good to me. So, yeah. And who knows? Maybe it is just an issue of I see so many movies that anything different looks wrong. And I know that's your working theory, Sean.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's because if you're so used to 24 frames per second, that's what you're expecting. 48 frames is going to look weird to you. I mean, that's how it's going to be. It's like, I don't know, it's like, you know, how people who have watched standard definition for so long can't, like, see the difference between high definition and standard definition, like our parents.
Yeah.
I think it's something like that.
But even then,
I'm really interested in seeing the 48 frames per second because I do have to say that I really notice motion blur with 24 frames per second movies a lot, and it bugs me. And so, like, I've always wanted for that to not be there because it always bugs me. I'm really intellectually curious into how this 48 frames per second pans out, and you know, who knows.
And when you see it, we'll have another discussion on the podcast because I definitely want to talk about that. But I guess the final issue is that for me, sort of the theory, people keep making the comparison you just made of like the jump from standard def to high def, and I don't know after seeing it if that's an apt comparison because in theory, 48 is supposed to make it look clearer. It did not look clear to me. There was, I guess there wasn't blur, but parts of the image just didn't look as good. And when I saw it in 24 frames per second, for instance,
it not looking as good might just be because it is more accurately representing reality. I mean, that's what it being that much clearer is what allows you to see the fact that everything's fake.
Right.
I think, and that is maybe the biggest problem with 48 frames per second and like getting clearer and clearer images is that you're going to become more and more conscious of this isn't reality, even though they're trying to represent reality.
Yeah.
You are trying to represent a false reality, and the clearer you make that, the more obvious it's going
right.
to be.
But that's my point, is that if the goal of photography is not just to say, okay, here's exactly what it looks like in real life, if the goal of photography is to do artistic enhancements, and 48 frames per second just completely takes that away, because Andrew Lesney did a great job shooting this movie, he's a great cinematographer, and his work looks like garbage to me in the higher frame rate. And at that point, I have to question what the purpose of the format is.
Well, I think it would be ideally, if it's executed properly, and there's a lot that would have to go into that, I think acting would have to, again, I haven't seen it, so I can't speak to particulars, but in my head, you'd have to shoot it differently, you'd have to act differently, because I think you act very deliberately when you're on film, so that it looks good on film, you know, you don't act in film the same way you would on stage or something like that. You'd have to change the way you make the movies, probably in a more comprehensive way than Peter Jackson did, but ultimately the goal would be that if it represents reality more accurately, you're going to be more involved and more immersed into the film world, which I think you and I don't have that problem because we're so much more experienced with film, but I think the goal is more for further generations down the line. And that's what it feels like to me. It's almost kind of the same thing where, you know, like we notice if there's like you're watching something digital as opposed to something that's on actual physical film stock, and that kind of bugs us.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not going to bug like 10-year-old kids, and when those 10-year-old kids are 40, still not going to bug them. So yeah. I think it's a generational thing.
And I want to mention, you know, you talk about film stock. Lord of the Rings was shot on 35mm, and they're gorgeous movies however you watch them. Even if you see them digitally, you can tell they were filmed on film. And The Hobbit, to me, either way you watch it, doesn't look quite as good because, I don't like digital as much as film, not even close. And at this point, digital photography is not at the same resolution. I mean, just mathematically, it does not have the same resolution as 35mm film. And even when you do the 48 frames, I don't think you're getting that. And, you know, I know I'm not going to get my wish of us all going back to 35mm projectors, and I'm not asking for that. It's just, it's something to notice. And we'll talk about that more when we get to the visuals of the film.
Yeah.
But we wanted to get this out of the way, so we're not going to talk about the frame rate or any of that. For now, we're just talking about the movie. Regular 2D, 24 frames, whenever we mention anything, just assume that's the version of the movie we're talking about. There's obviously no content differences in the film. So
the secret 24 frames that you get, it's a whole new movie. They're like completely different scenes in between the frames.
Yes. All right, so let's get this discussion started. Sean, you liked the movie. Why don't you start off elaborating your kind of thoughts on it overall?
Okay, so my overall thoughts are, I feel, again, I don't think it's quite as good as any of the Lord of the Rings movies. I don't know if, you know, it could have been, even if it was really, really good, because I have such nostalgic attachment to those. But I think this movie does not work as well on its... It works better on its own than something like, say, when they split the Harry Potter movie into two, where that was just one movie, that they just, like, fine, we're cutting it here. Kill Bill is like that, too. It's not quite like that, but it's not as good as, say, The Lord of the Rings, where there's a massive amount of screen time in this film that sets up films 2 and 3, which makes me really excited for films 2 and 3, but presents some problems in this film. Particularly, I think it makes the pacing feel a lot slower than it normally would, because there's not as much payoff, the things that they set up. I think my biggest complaints are there's way too much CG, and then there's some tonal inconsistency. Like, they sort of jump between, you know, heads being cut off and then dumb slapstick a bit too much. But other than that, I would say, you know, the acting is absolutely phenomenal. I think most of the effects that are not CG are really good. You know, the cinematography is really good. The music is amazing. And I really, really enjoyed it.
That's a great story.
Yeah, it's a great story.
I feel pretty much, I echo pretty much everything Sean says. I really liked this movie. I would say after a second viewing, I love it, because even with flaws, I'm going to love this movie even more than a movie that I think has fewer flaws, because I love this world. I love these characters. Lord of the Rings is my favorite film of all time. I did say after the first time I saw it, I think The Hobbit is mildly disappointing, and I don't mean, disappointing does not mean dislike.
Yeah.
It just means that if my expectations were, like, I was looking forward to this movie more than any other film this year, and I don't think it's a great movie. I think it's a damn good movie, and at times, it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
I think overall it's not great, certainly not in the way, like, you sit down and watch Fellowship for the first time, and you're like, yeah, that's one of the 10 best movies I've ever seen, no questions asked.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so when I say mildly disappointing, it's not a damning thing, it's not a world-ending thing, it's just there are things about it that could have been fixed and could be improved, and that's where the disappointment stems from. It's not an overall disappointment, it's just there are disappointing elements, and it's not as good as maybe I wanted it to be. But I agree with Sean, some of the things that disappoint in this movie do make me excited, though, for films 2 and 3, where I don't even see how they're going to have these issues, because that part of the story is so much more laser-focused anyway.
Yeah, I should say that the aspects of this movie I find are really hard to criticize, just because I find it hard to take this movie completely on its own.
Yeah.
Like, the aspects of the story and the pacing are such that I feel like we need to wait till the other two movies are out to, like, really look at it, whereas you don't necessarily need that for The Fellowship. I feel like this movie, since there's so much set up for subplots, we need to be able to see how those subplots resolve and look at those movies as like a big set, ultimately, to criticize that aspect.
And I get that, and I agree with that. So where I would say my complaints stem from this movie is there's structural issues, and this is irregardless of whether it's one movie or three. There are just things about how they present it and how they pace it that I think you could take all these same scenes, rearrange them a little bit, cut them down, whatever, and you could have the same story and story beats, but just present them in a way that feels more focused to me. I do think the first 90 minutes or so of this movie, there are some rough patches. And there are some rough patches to me because I think the movie, in the amount they've expanded the story, there are parts where I think they kind of lose the forest for the trees, where this The Hobbit is Bilbo Baggins' story. And I mean, there's a lot of other stuff going on, but the story is about the adventure is a backdrop for Bilbo's character development. And I think there are parts of the movie where they kind of forget that Bilbo is the main character. And it's not that I have some ungodly attachment to Bilbo Baggins. He has to be on screen at every moment. I don't need that. I don't want that. But I do feel like the movie loses its own sense of identity and focus in certain stretches. Like, as good as each scene in Rivendell is, and there are some great scenes in Rivendell, the fact that Bilbo does not have a single line of dialogue in that stretch of the movie is odd. And it's just a little awkward because we go for about 40 minutes there, from the Warg attack to they leave Rivendell, and then suddenly Bilbo's back in the spotlight, and you're like, oh yeah, he's in this movie. And that's sort of the issue that it doesn't matter whether this is the first film, the second film, whatever, that's kind of a structural problem.
I can, yes and no, because I still feel, because that section of the movie is focused on, we're going to set up a lot of the Dol Guldur type stuff.
Yeah, but you
that,
could...
For me, it's, Bilbo doesn't do much in that part of the story anyways, that it did bug me, but I don't think it bugged me as much as it does you, and mostly because I think, you know, they saved, I mean, even though they didn't show Bilbo a lot in sort of big sections of the movie, they did take a lot of pains to make Bilbo a lot more important to the story than he actually is in the book, and a lot more active. So it feels kind of...
And I agree with that, but here's a good example for me of a scene that's hurt by this. Is there's a phenomenal scene in Rivendell where Galadriel and Gandalf are talking. And you know the scene I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It's really good, where she asks Gandalf, why the halfling? Which is a good question to ask, because in the book...
Yeah, why the fuck? Why the fuck are you dragging Bilbo on this?
And it's a beautiful piece of writing where Gandalf explains sort of his view on goodness in the world. And it's very in touch with Gandalf's character. And Ian McKellen says it wonderfully. And he says, you know, why Bilbo Baggins? It's because, he says, because I'm scared and he gives me courage. And that's all great in theory, but I feel like at that point in the movie, we've spent so little time with Bilbo and we've spent relatively little time establishing Gandalf's relationship with Bilbo, especially as a focal point of this story, that when he says that, the emotional heft of it is not the same as the equivalent scene in, like, Fellowship, which is, they're obviously, I mean, they use the same piece of music. They're basically doing the scene from from the Mines of Mordor. It's equivalent to the Mines of Moria scene. It's equivalent to the Mines of Moria scene where Gandalf gives him the speech about, you know, so do all who live to see such times. With Frodo. And that resonates a little more powerfully because the focus of the story, I feel, is more in focus. And in this movie, when you get there, I don't know if that moment is totally earned. It's earned enough that it resonates, but not enough that it sort of resonates strongly for me.
I actually kind of have to disagree just because the very, I'd say like the first 30 minutes or so are all about Bilbo. Like they focus so heavily on, past the like sort of the prologue and giving some of the backstory. You know, they do focus a lot on Bilbo when he's in his home, it's the, like, unexpected party comes in, and all of that. I feel like they take a lot of pains to very much focus on Bilbo at the very beginning. Once they go on their journey, that's when it sort of loses track of him, because he's not doing anything.
Well, and I get that, but this is my... But, you know, whatever the story is, if it's an issue, it's an issue. And for me, like, in that scene, I think I can explain this a little more clearly. I guess where that moment does not feel entirely earned to me is... You know, Gandalf, as that scene kind of implies, and as the book implies, is that he picked Bilbo Baggins kind of on a hunch. And his hunch turns out to be right. But he's sort of, when he says this to Galadriel, what has Bilbo actually done in the story so far?
Nothing.
In nothing.
Yeah.
And that's, so how can that moment be earned totally when Bilbo Baggins has not really done anything yet?
They're not entirely true that he's done nothing.
In the troll scene.
Fought the trolls.
Yeah, but that's like, that's one thing. And so to me,
I think it's because he hasn't done anything to warrant the fact that he's on the journey yet that does make that scene kind of powerful, because you do get the sense that Gandalf's doing this on a hunch. And I do like they throw in some dialogue, some new dialogue that's not in the book, that more clarifies Gandalf and Bilbo's relationship, where when Bilbo was a small child, he and Gandalf knew each other, where Gandalf has a little
And that's a that's a great scene.
And that's, to me, that's where that kind of comes in, where that's where that feels earned to me. Because you do get the sense that Gandalf knows Bilbo.
Okay.
And that's where that comes in, is because he understands that Bilbo has this innocence and this honesty to him, and that's what reassures Gandalf so much. To me, that's where that scene works.
And that's fair. I just think there are some clunky elements here and there, and I guess I'll just continue talking about these structural issues for a minute with me. But, like, it's sort of interesting because you open the film with the prologue about Erebor. And it's a very well done scene, and it's very good, and I think that's probably how you have to open it, because that's a chunk of exposition you don't want anywhere else in this series. Mm-hmm. Because if you had to, if at the unexpected party, Thorin had to sit down and explain that to Bilbo, the movie would die. I mean, that wouldn't work. So doing it as a prologue with Ian Holm, good decision. I think there's some clunky things there where you come back from the prologue, and then he starts narrating again, and then he stops so Frodo can come in, and then Frodo leaves, and they make a bunch of Ian jokes about fellowship, and then he starts again, and then we get into the past. It's sort of like it stops and starts and stops and starts, but it's a good scene overall. But then I feel like, so then you have, as you just said, the unexpected party scene very much focuses on Bilbo, and it does a really good job at it. But then once they leave, before they really get into the adventure, we have to have more exposition scenes, where we have the whole thing about Azog and Thorin, and the whole thing about Gandalf explaining all the wizards, and then we go meet Radagast. And I guess that's less of a structural issue than just a pacing thing for me, where it feels, it's kind of, that part of the movie is slow, and I hate to use that word slow, because it's kind of a lazy criticism, but that part just doesn't have maybe the movement I feel like it probably needs.
Yeah, I agree. Again, it's because it is setting up these set plots, setting up, okay, Azog's going to come in, he's going to be the main antagonist, and then there's Radagast, and he's doing all the stuff with Dol Guldur, and all that stuff's meant to pay off in later films.
Right, and as I said to you before we recorded this podcast, I think you could fix those pacing issues, or at least alleviate them to a degree, if you just did the troll scene before those two bits of exposition, so it feels like once the company starts talking about stuff, they're doing it in a context of they've already accomplished something. They've already started moving. Their adventure's underway more than just walking. That would have alleviated that for me a little bit. Or not even a little bit. That would have alleviated it for me a lot. Because they did the troll scene, they did really well. And I really like how they did it. And I like how they sort of reoriented it around Bilbo. It's a lot of really smart adaptation choices there for me. So, but again, I think once the company gets to Rivendell, that's when the movie just clicks for me, and it starts getting really good, especially the scene in the cave where Bilbo and Beaufort have their conversation, and that's the moment to me where the movie starts hitting me emotionally in the way The Lord of the Rings did, and from there on out, I think it's a phenomenal film.
Yeah, I agree. Although, I also have to say that I feel... This movie feels a lot like Fellowship of the Ring to me, where it does have... It has the exact same sort of, like, overall structure. It's got, like, you know, it's got the prologue... It's got a lot of exposition, a lot of walking, and like getting to Rivendell. And once you get to Rivendell, it's like fast-paced action. You go into the caves, you know, and then you have like this like action climax in the cave, and then a second action climax in Fellowship at Amon Hinn, and then here with the trees and the frying pan and the fire stuff. It's like it's got to me. I think this movie feels a lot like Fellowship, and I think Fellowship kind of has some similar problems, but it alleviates it by not having to set up so many subplots, whereas The Hobbit does,
and
that's where the pacing comes in.
Well, and The Fellowship has it's an easier story to do built in,
exactly.
Because Frodo is always the most important person in this book.
Yeah.
Just always, because he's the ring bearer. And obviously
Bilbo is not important at all until he starts doing stuff. And they put him in doing stuff earlier in this movie than he does in the
book. I think the main problem with An Unexpected Journey is that, so you talk about in Fellowship, the first half is getting to Rivendell, but a lot more stuff happens on the journey to Rivendell in Fellowship.
Because you do have the Nazgul.
Yeah.
That's like, that is the one thing that sort of happens, is
right.
They encounter the Nazgul.
Well, they meet a lot of people and a lot of stuff happens, and we kind of, it's all sent, the whole story is Frodo-centric. And then it opens up when you get to Rivendell. This story kind of, it starts, it's sort of, the first half is not Bilbo-centric, and then it sort of recontextualizes around Bilbo for the last hour and a half or so, or last hour, whatever. And so, and I get that, and it's a tough book to adapt, especially in this setting.
Yeah, because by them splitting up the story, this is why I feel like, while I do kind of agree with you that it does have pacing issues, I feel like I'm not justified in criticizing it too much just because I don't know how it's ultimately going to pan out, because it feels like it so needs the other movies for me to be able to criticize that aspect of this movie that I don't really want to go into it too much.
I think overall, I wrote in my first review that I was not convinced that it needed the three-film treatment.
I think it does.
And I just want to say, after I saw it a second time, I am.
Yeah.
I think even if this one is a little bit clunky because of that, I think if films two and three are as good as we expect them to be, A, one will look much better in context, and B, two and three will be better for having had this foundation.
Yeah.
And I'm fine with that. I mean, that's
sort of the way it has to be with when you're doing this with, like, this one story up in
this
just, way.
Yeah, and I think the main thing for me is the stretch between, like, I guess what you would say chapters one and two in this movie, it feels like so much time is passing without a damn thing happening, and that's an issue. As you said, it's an issue that maybe will look better in context.
Yeah,
it's
because, again, if you think about this as being, like, a 10-hour long movie, that's not a big deal. Like, having this, like, big stretch of exposition, that's not a big deal in context of 10 hours.
It just, I do think, both times I watched it, I could feel this, the sort of the straining to get from, it takes them 80 minutes in this movie to get to chapter 2 of the book, and that's not a huge problem, but it's something, and it's not even a thing where I'm going to blame them for doing that, it's just the way they chose to do it, it's a little odd. So, I think those are my major complaints, storytelling-wise, with the movie.
Yeah.
We should probably start talking about what we love about this movie.
Okay.
So, do we want to keep with the story, do you think, for now?
Sure.
Okay, I think that's a good way to do it, because, so I think we should just kind of probably go point by point. What did you think about sort of the prologue and how they presented the story of Erebor?
I liked it. Yeah, I think, again, I think that was a smart decision, starting with you have the exposition, you kind of show what the lives of the dwarves are like, and you sort of set up, they very much make you realize, okay, this is about the quest to Erebor, this is what's important, this is what the dwarves are trying to do, and you get that sense in that context at the very beginning. I think it works just as well as the prologue to Fellowship.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing. Again, I said, after you finished that part of the prologue, there's some clunky things for me, but it's... Did you like seeing Elijah Wood again?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That side of it, too. Yeah. I thought that was... Maybe, I think a lot of people who don't have as much fondness for the Lord of the Rings movies, it would bother them a bit more, because I think it was kind of very start and stop, but it felt... I don't know. It really got me into the mood, having that, and sort of having that ease you into going back into the Lord of the Rings film, and just having Elijah Wood there and having the realizing, okay, this is like moments before the beginning of the Fellowship. And it actually kind of, if you do the extended edition, is kind of at the same time because he's writing the, you know, in the whole, there lived the Hobbit.
Yeah.
I really like that. It really helped me get into the mood. I like that aspect of it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it potentially creates some continuity problems because in this movie, Frodo tells him he's leaving. And then in the extended cut of Fellowship, he doesn't know where Frodo is. So there's...
It's his 11th birthday. Okay. He's an old man. He probably would have forgotten that.
Right. No, I like that scene too, because obviously I think Elijah Wood's a phenomenal actor and he's a great Frodo, and I just liked seeing him again. This is something I don't know if this bothered me, but I noticed it. There are a lot of references here just to Fellowship, including a line that I don't know if I needed, which was, we have to get the backstory of why Frodo is in the woods at the beginning of Fellowship. I don't know, it felt a little, like, in-jokey to me, too much.
I don't know, I think... I didn't get that sense from it at
does
all.
Does it enhance your understanding of Fellowship of the Ring to know that Frodo was sitting there reading so he could see
Gandalf? I don't think it's meant to. It's just giving you some context as to when this is happening, and it's like, might as well happen right before Fellowship of the Ring begins. I wouldn't even look at it as being sort of an in-joke. It was just sort of...
Well, but here's what I would say. I got really excited when Frodo and Bilbo go outside, and I see Frodo with the book, and he's going to go walk off. And I thought, oh, this is cool. This is happening the same thing as Fellowship. How cool is this? And then he has to say it and re-underline what I got, because he's holding the book and he's walking off into the woods. I mean, it's one of those things where I wonder if they hammered it home too far for me.
I don't know. I don't think it was that bad. It wasn't as bad as, like, my name is Robin. You know? It wasn't like that.
No. But, you know, it's fine.
But
all right.
That didn't bother me.
So we go back and we meet young Bilbo, Martin Freeman.
Yes.
And I really, really liked the scene where Gandalf comes to visit him and they do the whole good morning
thing. Yeah.
Because it's one of my favorite Tolkien bits of writing ever. Yeah. And Ian McKellen kills it. It's awesome.
Yeah, definitely. Because I had forgotten how just great that their, like, first conversation is, where it's just going on about good morning. It's like, this is a morning to be good on. All that stuff was just, like, you know, it was great, yeah.
So then the first sort of big scene of the movie is an unexpected party. And this is obviously a very tricky scene to do on film, because it's a very long scene and it's a very exposition-heavy scene, and exposition both in the sense of we're learning about the plot and we're meeting 13 characters.
Yeah.
And meaning Bilbo, really, in the original book, and sort of reintroducing ourselves to Bilbo in this new context in this movie. So how do you feel they did this scene?
I think it was really good. I think that, again, I think they... While not all 13 dwarves are particularly, like, well-characterized, which, you know, they never could be, I do think they do a really good job of... I think it's Dwalin is the first one that comes in. He's bald, and then there's, like, Balin comes in. It's like, Feely and Keely also feel like they have some pretty strong characterizations. one of the Oris, I think it might have been Nori, is sort of like the pompousy, like, he's giving everyone tea. There's like, they do a good job of sort of like the introducing you very slowly to some of these characters and giving them some character traits so you recognize them and are able to think, like, you feel familiar with almost all the 13 dwarves in some way.
I definitely want to. That has to. Well, we'll definitely, when we talk about characters, we have to talk about all the dwarves, because I think that's maybe my favorite part of this movie is how well they did the dwarves. But we'll talk about that in a little bit. Just in the context of this scene, though, you liked how they were all introduced and everything.
Yeah.
And I liked, I think they did a good job, and this is why you cast Martin Freeman, because he's very good at reactions.
Yeah.
And and that's what that whole scene is about, and I think there's some very good material in this first scene of just him reacting to the dwarves, starting to learn, you know, what they're all about and getting through all this. But then there's also some really nice moments just between him and Gandalf, for instance, and him deciding, you know, kind of hearing about both sides of this adventure and kind of running through the pros and cons.
Yeah.
And I think it's a scene that, I don't think it has pacing issues. It's differently paced than we're used to the beginning of a movie being done, because it's a very long opening scene. But I think it's a very entertaining scene, and I enjoyed all of it.
Yeah,
and
I think it was funny.
Yeah.
I think that was good that it was funny.
Yeah, I mean, the whole smash the bottles, crack the plates, that's what Bilbo Baggins hates.
Yeah.
I thought they did a good job with that, making it sound a little more improvisational.
Kind of. Okay. Not really. I think they maybe shouldn't have done that.
Oh,
that
really?
That kind of, as much as I am fond of the songs, that one felt weird. Just having it be in this, you know, it works okay in the animated film, because the animated film is completely ridiculous and cheesy and campy and over the top. And this is like having them all actually be people and everything, and having sort of like the CGI plates and stuff is like, yeah, that's a bit much.
Yeah. In any case, it's kind of a funny scene. There's a good reaction, though, after it, with Gandalf saying, oh, they're quite a merry gathering.
Yeah.
I like how Gandalf kind of, you can tell, maybe Gandalf is annoyed by them too, but he's kind of getting off on Bilbo being annoyed.
Yeah.
But it's a well-done scene, and I think it establishes the chemistry of the group pretty well. The next scene I want to talk about, because this is one of my favorite adaptative choices in the movie, is that in the book, Bilbo goes to sleep, and he wakes up late, all the dwarves have left, and he thinks he's just going to get to, you know, go back to his hobbit ways of just eating and drinking. And then in the book, Gandalf comes in and is like, oh, get the fuck out of here, and Bilbo runs. But here, they have Bilbo walk around, there's just some very nice silent work from Martin Freeman. He's very relieved, and then he sees the contract, and we just cut to him running.
Yeah.
I loved that.
Yeah, I especially like the small moment where he's, like, the house is completely empty and just destroyed, and it makes you very conscious of how it's, like, empty now, and it was so full of life before, and it sort of, like, gives you, you sort of understand a bit why Bilbo decides to go on this journey. Yeah, I agree with you, I really like that moment.
And the music, the Howard Shore score there is wonderful, of sort of taking the Shire theme and making it into an adventure theme. It very much indicates that he's still the Bilbo he's always been, but now he's moving in a new direction.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. And I like that the way they adapted this scene and gave Bilbo more agency in it.
Yeah.
It also enhances sort of your interpretation of the story, where I think you can read that scene in quite a few different ways.
Yeah.
In terms of why does he choose to go? And they're never going to be able to answer that 100%, and that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's one of the great things about The Hobbit, is you always have to ask yourself, why did Bilbo ultimately do this? And I think just leaving it open to viewer interpretation and never really getting into that is a really good choice, because then the more you watch Bilbo, the more you come to your own conclusions on why he did it.
Yeah.
And it also makes the movie, to me, sort of stand separate from the book as its own entity.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is really due mostly to Martin Freeman, I feel, because he's so good. They make Bilbo such a great, compelling character.
Yeah.
And so likable, and you do get so invested into him at this point in the movie that I think talking about it, I understand a bit more why you miss his presence as much as you do.
Because
he's so good.
Yeah. Because after that scene, once he gets to the dwarves and gets his pony, Bilbo, again, is just kind of gone for the next 20 minutes, because we have to have the whole scene with Azog and Thorin and the backstory, and then the whole scene with Radagast. And I think that's my pacing issue, structural issue, is that I feel at that moment so invested in Bilbo and in Martin Freeman, and I love this character so much, and I just want to see a little more how he operates in this world and in this context. And that's why I think if you had gone, like, after one scene of traveling straight into the troll scene, which is, again, all about how Bilbo operates in this context, that would have done more for me. And then you could go right...
But then you would still have this long... Like, no matter what you do, you're going to be away from Bilbo. I just think you don't want to be away from Bilbo, because he is so well done in this film.
Right. But you kind of get what I'm getting at.
I mean, yeah, I already...
You don't have to agree.
But I think maybe it is maybe motivated a lot more by how likable Bilbo is than you are willing to admit, as far as it...
He's very...
Aside from it being structural issues and more being your attachment to the character.
That's part of it, and I will never deny that. It's definitely part of that, and they do a good job, and I think the choices they made in the first act... The first act goes on a lot longer than just this, but this section of the movie is very well done. So the next section, as we said, is Balin gets to tell us the story of Azog and the Siege of Moria and...
Thorin's sort of grand backstory.
Yes. And this is even if the structure of this annoys me, it's a phenomenal scene on its own. I really like it. And I think it's a cool battle, and Thorin is a fucking badass.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely.
I mean, we'll talk a lot more about Thorin when we get into characters, but he's cool.
Yeah.
And this scene you already kind of get that sense from the dinner scene that he's kind of a badass.
Yeah.
But you don't know until you see him go at Azog with his fucking Oakenshield.
Yeah. I do like how, in my head, because they do have that where he takes up the branch and that's where the Oakenshield thing kind of comes from, but it's like, I never pictured it in my head, and actually seeing it visually, I didn't realize using a branch as a shield could look so fucking cool.
I know.
Like, why does that look so fucking cool? I have no idea.
I think it's because Richard Taylor, the head of Weta, is a fucking genius at design. And it's a good design.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's a good scene. And I think, I like there's a lot of good writing in this movie, too. I mean, we know just Peter Jackson, Fran Walsh, and Philippa Boyens are good at dialogue.
Yeah.
And I think, I like how Balin narrates this. And he has his whole thing at the end, like, that's someone I could follow. Mm-hmm. That's someone I could call king. And as we see Richard Armitage as Thorin sort of standing on the hillside. And it's a tricky thing to do because you don't want to deify a character like that, but you want to build his legacy up. And I think they built his legacy very well in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I completely agree. Yeah. Although it is, that's like the moment in the film, though, where it was like when they cut off Thor's head and it's like, and as I'm like, chucks it, I'm like, this is not a kid's movie. It's like,
I think we should probably talk about that just really quickly now, is that it is odd to me that I think so much of the movie does a really good job tonally being a little lighter like The Hobbit should be, but I think some of the violence, like, did they need to go that far?
Yeah, no, there's, like, that's one of my biggest complaints with the movie, is there's some of those tonal imbalances where there's a lot more comedy in this, but there's still, like, maybe not as much, but actually, some of the violence feels a little more, like, gory to me than some of the stuff in Fellowship. Like, there's some, like, cutthroats and stuff that, like, they focus on a bit more than, like, where...
Well, and how they kill the Goblin King, they just slit his stomach open.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's moments like that, whereas in Lord of the Rings, you know, I think the most violent that gets is when, you know, Aragorn fights Lurtz at the very end.
Or Boromir, you get to hit the shafts in him.
Yeah, but that's not, like, quite as... Like, that's really impactful, and it is violent, but it's not like, you know, a dude's got his arm cut off, and it's not like these, like, open wounds and stuff.
Right, it is.
It's more like... It's like, a lot of the violence in Lord of the Rings films is more like that, where it's like, it's dudes getting hit by swords, but it's sort of, you know, cartoony in that they get hit by swords and they're dead. It's not like they're being cut apart.
Yeah, and I agree, and I think it's one of those things where it's maybe like 30 seconds of the movie overall, and if they just changed those overall 30 seconds, this would be a great movie for kids. But as it stands, I don't know if I would show this to a 6 or 7 year old.
Yeah, no. I definitely wouldn't, unless they were, you know, pretty badass 6 or 7 year old. Yeah. I'm not going to show them the scene where Thor gets his head cut off and then like chucked down the hill. Yeah,
or like at the end where Aslan is like, "Give me his head," and the goblin like puts his, you know, sword on Thorin's throat, and you can hear Thorin, like, gurgling, and it's like, that's a little intense, guys.
Yeah, yeah. It's weirdly violent in some places, and this is the first time it happens. Right there.
We'll see. Maybe, like, are they, in film two, are they, like, on a really graphically depict Smaug, like, melting people? Like there's gonna be a guy, like, whose arm was in the fire and his skin's melting off, and he's like, oh, God!
It's like, you know, it's like when they kill Smaug, it's going to be Kill Bill style, like blood spurts just like shooting out. Yeah.
Everything will go in black and white as Bilbo fights some goblins.
Yeah. Although it does kind of make me wonder now to think about it for the third film, how brutal is the Battle of Five Armies going to be if this is sort of how the tone of the violence they're going for?
I expect it's going to be pretty fucked up.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's a choice, and it's not the worst choice in the world, but it's a choice that...
I think it's a mistake overall.
It's a mistake. Yeah.
It's either a mistake that they went too far with the humor or they went too far with the violence. It's just like they tried to go for both of it, but that's what the mistake is to me.
But that's the thing, though. When you watch the movie, it's the violence that feels like the outlier, because by and large, the movie's pretty...
I feel like they both feel like outliers okay. in a lot of places.
But I mean...
Mostly just because some of the humor is a bit too slapsticky for my taste.
I agree, but those... I mean, just sort of the general tone of the movie, no matter what, is lighter.
Yeah.
Than Lord of the Rings. And I
think when you have like all the trolls and the Goblin King talking
yeah.
and then you're killing them, it makes it feel a lot more real than defeating monsters.
But even when you get to Rivendell, Elrond's a happier fellow, Saruman's a happier fellow.
That's because they're not having to deal with the impending destruction of the entire world.
But that's the point. This is inherently a lighter story, and I think generally if you don't go to the outliers, the tone of the movie is consistent and well done.
Yeah,
but then you have. I agree. I think you could probably cut both those outliers,
mm-hmm.
and then I think the middle of the tone is very well done.
Yeah, I agree.
So, in any case, we were talking about the Azog scene. That's where CGI comes into the movie, and I think we'll talk about that later because that's a big discussion.
That's a whole thing.
Azog, why did? Never mind. Yeah. In any case, we go from that, and then we meet Radagast the Brown. And, Sean, this is your man, Sylvester McCoy.
Yes.
What did you think of Radagast and his subplot?
I really liked it. Even though there's not any payoff, I thought I was really interested in that. Mostly because it's... Even though I have read these appendices and I've read most of the Silmarillion, so I kind of know the material, it still feels a lot more new to me than the stuff happening in The Hobbit, where, you know, when I'm just watching The Hobbit, it's like, okay, the troll scene's coming up, they're going to get to Rivendell, they're going to get to the mountains and everything, and so I kind of know where they're going, and having something feels like it's new, but it's not out of place, I really like that. And then
I agree.
Really like Sylvester McCoy.
I think Radagast is a really good example of how they handle tone in this movie, for instance, because he's a character who's a little more lighter and more in touch with nature. Obviously, he's very in touch with nature. So when you have him sort of encountering the necromancer, that feels much more tonally correct for the Hobbit than if Gandalf went and found the necromancer.
Mm-hmm. And just the whole scene where he goes up into Dol Guldur, and then you see like the statue of one of the Nazgul, and like the Witch King ghost comes out, and all of that stuff. And then there's like the brief shot of like the crazy shadow like silhouette that's the necromancer, Sauron. It's like all that stuff I thought was so fucking cool, and it kind of made me like, I wish I could see more of that stuff.
Yes.
Even though I love the Bilbo stuff so much, having something that feels really new is really interesting to me.
And I completely agree. Again, I have structural issues with how it's presented, but the scenes themselves are great.
Yeah.
I just think the introduction to Radagast and the design of the forest he lives in and all the creatures, really cool.
Yeah.
And I know this is getting more into character, but I think it's so crucial to the plot here, you got to talk about Radagast. But I think they handle really well... because the trailers kind of suggested Radagast was going to be nuttier than he actually is, and I like that he's kind of nutty and out there, but he feels like definitely a part of this world.
I agree. And I think... And also, this section of the movie has the saddest single moment where he's got Sebastian.
Sebastian!
He's got, the hedgehog thing. It's like... And then you think it dies for a second? That, like, broke my heart. That I've never felt like... so attached to a CGI animal. Like, I feel like, to me, I felt like in that moment how people felt in the one Doctor Who episode with the Triceratops, where the Triceratops dies, and online everyone was like, oh, they killed the Triceratops. It's like, they killed Sebastian at first.
To me, that's all. Sylvester McCoy plays it so well.
Yeah, I mean, he's like... broke my fucking heart, man.
I know. It's like, because you feel for Radagast.
Because, I don't know, I think that it was really smart of them to sort of introduce Radagast in that way.
Yeah.
Where you show him being protective of the forest, and he's there, and he's got, like, this, like, you know, this one really insignificant little hedgehog, and he has a name for it, and he cares for it, like, it's his own, like, child, and he, like, takes it back to his big hut and everything. It's like, it instantly makes that character very likable. And I agree. A lot of that goes to Sylvester McCoy just being awesome.
And here we also have foreshadowing to the spiders.
Oh yeah, that was really cool. And I like how at first you didn't know what was outside of his hut, because I was like, what the fuck is outside? Like, what is coming for him? And then you like see the legs, it's like, oh shit.
It's a great foreshadowing
for the spiders.
It's a great moment of foreshadowing, because it doesn't take you out of like this movie. Like, it's foreshadowing, but if you don't know it's foreshadowing, it's not going to distract you. It's just like, oh, there's something out there. But if you know, it's like, that's...
Yeah, it's cool, and they don't show too much of the spiders.
It's sort of similar to how they handle Smaug in this movie. It's like, we're hinting, and it's just enough to get you interested, but not play their hand
too
early. So well done there. So that's all the Radagast material. Then we get into the section with the trolls. Or actually, I should mention, before we get to the trolls, there's a scene where Thorin and Gandalf talk about going to the Hidden Valley in Rivendell. Did you like how they really brought this more in line with Lord of the Rings of Thorin having a prejudice against the elves?
Yeah, I did like how they sort of were like pressing that where, yeah, the dwarves and the elves do not particularly get along.
And I like that they give
you
a really...
that sense.
And yeah. I love that for Thorin there's a clear reason. It's not just prejudice, it's that they fucking betrayed him once.
Thranduil is kind of a dick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thranduil, who is not Russian in this movie.
Well,
he could be.
He hasn't talked yet, so we can only hope. At the very least, he's not this like weird 5-foot-tall, half-leg blue monster guy.
Would have been great if they could have gotten Walter Koenig to play him.
Yeah.
Okay. In any case, so I just wanted to mention that scene because I like how they've embellished that and really because that's how we expect the dwarves to act, and it gives you greater context for, say, Gimli's actions in Fellowship.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good things in this movie that when you go back and watch Fellowship now, it feels a little richer. And that should be the goal of any prequel.
Yeah.
So, well done there. Then we get into the troll scene. Now, this is... all the basics are sort of there from how it happens in the book, but they're recontextualized and they're rearranged a little bit. And what did you think of this scene?
Now, I really liked it. Although, I do have to say, even though I like the change where Bilbo is more, like, centric to how the trolls get defeated... it's a little bit frustrating that I've now seen two adaptations of The Hobbit on screen, and neither of them do the thing where Gandalf tricks the trolls.
Yeah.
So, like, that means that now someone's going to have to make another Hobbit movie just so I can see that scene on screen now.
It is too bad, because Ian McKellen is the perfect Gandalf, and he always will be. So, he will never get to do that.
Yeah, so it's like, it's a smart choice, but I wish... like, maybe on the DVD, this like they put that scene in there, too. Like, because I want it both ways. I want to have that scene, just because I like that scene in the book so much, and I want to see Ian McKellen do it, but the version they do is smarter for this movie. It's a lot smarter for this movie. The decision I was not expecting to be made, and I would not have thought to make, and then as soon as I see it, I'm like, that's really smart. That's
an
incredibly smart decision to make.
Well, there's another change there that I like, which is that while Bilbo is sort of being... held captive, the dwarves come in, and in the book they just kind of trip over themselves and get captured, but they fucking fight.
Yeah, they have a nice little fight scene.
And
here,
it's good.
Yeah.
And I like that during that fight, Bilbo very proactively tries to get the ponies out. He does.
Yeah.
He cuts them loose, he saves
and
the day.
So the ponies run away, so they lose all their ponies, so it was not the smartest decision of him to make, but
for all he knew, they were about to get eaten.
Yeah.
And, you know. But it's a good scene, and you still get Gandalf doing something there.
Mm-hmm.
Cracks the rock.
Yeah.
So.
Although, unfortunately, there was no appearance by Pirate Troll. Eyepatch Troll was not present in the movie.
This is true.
So.
Did you like how they handled the trolls as characters?
Yeah, I did. I think it's sort of one of the weird things with the tone where it took me a little bit to get used to the fact that the trolls were talking just because I'm so used to in the Lord of the Rings universe, the Lord of the Rings movies. They took much more pains to make, like, you know, the orcs and the Uruk-hai and the trolls to all feel like they're just monsters. And so it's, like, a lot easier for me to accept that they're being killed. Whereas in this, you know, you have the trolls talk, and then later when you get to the goblins, the Goblin King, the goblins talk a lot. And they, like, feel like they're more full characters, whereas, like, feels like it's kind of weird that all these characters are being killed. And it makes it... and again, thought occurs to me... are the trolls still alive when they're encased in stone?
Really occurred to me here because of how they do it sort of gradually, and like they look so tortured as they're being frozen.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I get that they're... like, I felt bad for the trolls because I get that the trolls kind of need to die. But, you know, they're trolls. They need to eat stuff, and not a lot is going to satisfy a troll's hunger, you know? So...
yeah, and here's...
made me feel very sympathetic for the trolls, ultimately. Because they did make the trolls really likable, because they were really fucking funny. I liked the trolls, and it made it kind of weird. Like, I felt like the trolls were nice guys, so it made it kind of weird when all of a sudden they were, like, threatening to kill the characters that I liked.
Well, and here's another question about, sort of, in this context, when they're frozen, and if they are conscious, does that mean their wounds still hurt from the battle they just had? Like, throughout time?
And does it, like, it seems like it would make it sting really bad, too, because now it's covered up in stone. Yeah. Yeah.
Poor trolls.
Yeah, man. Those trolls got fucked up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe there's, like, a post-credit scene where, like, it's just a shot of the stone trolls and you hear one of them go,
ah. Or it's like, this is a close-up on his face and there's, like, one, like pebble tear, like, falls down his cheek.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Okay. So, enough about that. The next scene is when they find all the trolls'
stuff.
Yeah,
they get their loot drop. And this, and having it sort of like realized on screen just make it feel really weirdly conspicuous that they have these like ancient elven blades.
It's a little weird because
in their troll hole, where I never really thought about that before. It's like, why the fuck are these like blades forged by the elves of Gondolin in the First Age? These high kings, ancient beings of Middle Earth. Just sort of, I mean, Galadriel is the sword of the king of Gondolin at one point. It's like, why the fuck is that here? It sort of made it sort of like, that's weird.
Yeah, it is. It is weird.
I don't know why I never thought about that much before.
Yeah.
It's having it, like, realized on screen. There's a few things like that in this movie where having it realized on screen, all of a sudden I'm like, that's kind of weirder than it was then. That I ever realized before.
Yeah. I do like, really, really like, the scene where Gandalf gives Bilbo Sting, and he has that conversation. That's a really nice scene. It's like, you know, it's not when to take a life, but when to spare one. And Bilbo sees it, and Bilbo's got his doubts.
Which, although, again, that, like, them saying that makes it that much weirder once they start, like, fucking killing a bunch of goblins, and the goblins feel a lot more characterized, and, you know, Gandalf, like, cuts his head off, like, one of their heads off, and, like, knocks it off with his staff. It's like, no, I went to spare a life, man. Come on. I mean, you don't need to go around killing every motherfucker you run into.
Even better, did Gandalf really need to drop the rock and crush them all while they're running?
Yeah, I know, right? It's just... Yeah, there's some weird... It's just because...
Well, Gandalf can dish it, but he can't take it.
I think there's just something about, like, having the violence realized physically, like, on screen, compared to it just being, like, a couple of sentences in a book that makes it stand out to the much lighter tone of The Hobbit so much more that it's like... Man, dude, you're killing a lot of, like, sentient creatures right now that maybe you shouldn't be. That you could probably get out of this situation without killing all these people.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a nice scene no matter what.
Yeah.
And from there, I think, we get into... They meet Radagast, and it's kind of nice to... I like having Radagast bump into the group.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that all of a sudden Radagast would, like, pop up in this, like, story, because, you know, he obviously doesn't in The Hobbit, so it's like, all of a sudden, it's like, oh, holy shit, Radagast is right here. It makes his scene in Dol Guldur feel less out of place, the fact that he pops up and interacts with the main group.
It does, and what I like is that he assists, because then the wargs come, and it's kind of awesome that Radagast leads them away with his awesome rabbits.
Yeah, his rabbit sled thing.
Yep, that's a great thing. Cool. Yeah. So that's awesome, and then I guess we should talk about how they've, sort of, the wargs and the orcs, that's a part of the book, but they very much embellished it and added it into other parts of the story. And I think it works. Like, I like that they're driven to Rivendell by more than just, well, we're kind of tired and hungry. It's that we're about to die.
Yeah, no, they
it's a
do.
Good action scene.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the biggest changes to the story in this movie is that they very intentionally... I mean, it all kind of resolves around the Azog character, so I think we'll talk about it more later. But they make you feel like there is this pressure that they are being chased, that there are these... Well, they characterize those orcs so much more in this movie than they ever are in the books, where it's just like kind of like this is a band of orcs that are here, like that with for like the frying pan and stuff like that. That it makes me look forward to the other movies to see all that stuff kind of come to a head, because I imagine they'll be involved.
Yeah,
they'll be the orcs that come in the Battle of Five Armies. So to like, it gives this nice overall structure, this nice antagonist before Smaug, so it doesn't feel like this movie's sort of empty and not having an antagonist.
I agree, and I really do like. I think it even makes. It makes the out of the frying pan into the fire scene much better for me than it even is in the book.
I agree.
Because there's something.
Yeah, it feels like there's a reason for it to be there.
And we know the
just
threat
having a nice
better.
Little action scene. Yeah.
And we know the threat better. It's there's not just okay, these are wolves we've never seen before. It's that these guys almost fucking killed them.
Mm-hmm.
But that scene where they're running though across the big valley is one of the most beautifully shot scenes in this movie. I don't know where that is in New Zealand, but it's incredible.
Yeah, because
it's this massive field and then just. Mountains, like the most beautiful mountains you've ever seen, all around it. And it's like, it's one of those moments where you realize, yes, this is why New Zealand is Middle Earth. I mean, that's Middle Earth. That's the Misty Mountains and the stuff in front of it. Like, that's how you imagine it in the book, but more beautiful than your imagination could ever conjure. And having an action scene set there is great.
Yeah, I agree.
And then they get into Rivendell, and there's a lot of stuff happening in Rivendell.
Yeah, and this is where Bilbo kind of like, completely exits the movie where he's like just not even in scenes anymore.
Yeah.
Which,
I mean, actually past the troll scene, he doesn't really talk much.
He doesn't talk much, but he's there.
Yeah.
It's like in Rivendell, it really feels like it like kind of cuts away. That's like, it becomes pretty conspicuous once you get out of Rivendell. It's like, oh yeah, Bilbo was not like, Bilbo just wasn't there. We didn't see him. He was not there for like that whole section of the movie.
Yeah. But this section is really good.
Yeah.
Because you get fucking Hugo Weaving, you get fucking Christopher Lee, and goddamn, you get Cate Blanchett, and they're all awesome. And
fuck yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't think I would get such a kick out of Cate Blanchett and Ian McKellen being on screen together, but I really do. Because
it makes you realize that
they never interacted.
Yeah, because Gandalf fell before they got to Lothlorien, so they never were on screen together, and you've, like, kind of realized that.
Yeah, but just, like, that power team. Like, I feel like there could be a spinoff with just those four. It'd be like the Avengers.
The White Council.
Yeah, the White Council. And it's a fun scene, and I kind of like how not only are they tying together things for this series, the Hobbit movies, of how they're going to have to go, you know, get rid of the Necromancer, but it's also sort of indicating that the world is changing to the world we're going to see in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, you do, because they sort of, you know, you see, it's really fucking interesting to see Saruman before he becomes a villain.
Because I like that he's still kind of a dick.
Yeah, he's still a total fucking asshole, so it makes sense that he's going to become a villain, but it doesn't feel like he's, like, you know, he's operating against anybody, because he obviously isn't yet. So you can see why he becomes a villain, but it's really interesting to see him not having taken that step yet.
My favorite part of it is when Gandalf mentions Radagast, and he starts going off on, like, well, he's been eating mushrooms, and then he's talking and talking, and Galadriel just drowns him out.
They have their, like, Professor X, Jean Grey, like, telepath conversation while Christopher Lee's just going on and on about Sylvester McCoy being a stoner.
Yeah, I mean, Galadriel, the more I watch The Lord of the Rings, the more I realize that she's really one of my favorite parts of that trilogy, because she's just so interestingly done. Like, she's
this is my favorite stuff with Galadriel, because you get this sense of her power.
I do too, because I like that it puts her in context more than in The Lord of the Rings when you put her next to Gandalf.
Yeah.
Because Gandalf, we think, is the most powerful, but then Galadriel, he's fucking putting in her hands.
Yeah, no, like, I really like those scenes with Galadriel in particular, because you know, she never got to do that much in The Lord of the Rings, but maybe they put more for her in The Lord of the Rings movies with all sort of the narration element. And having her here, like, interacting with these characters, and you get the sense of how powerful she is and how important she is to this world, is a really good treat.
Really good stuff.
Yeah.
The other big scene in Rivendell is the Moon Rune scene, which I really like. I think they did. Because we've always talked about how that's a really fun, mystical scene in the book.
Yeah.
And the visuals for it in the movie are great, where they go out to that place where he's got, like, the moon reading table.
Yeah, they got, like, the waterfall and the moon reading table.
It's because I like seeing more corners of Rivendell here.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's an extended cut, I hope there's more in Rivendell, because it feels like they really embellished it, and I like that.
Yeah. Well, because there are some scenes in the trailers that are very obviously set in Rivendell with Bilbo that you just don't see because
pacing issues. I think the movie will be improved with a little more Bilbo there.
Probably, but it'll probably also be, like, a, you know, 20 minutes longer, ultimately. Yeah. But
Peter Jackson said the extended cut is actually finished and it's 25 minutes longer.
Oh, I'm not that far off.
Yeah. So in any case, that's sort of anything else to say about the Rivendell section? There's a change here, too, that the elves are a little more antagonistic. Like, Elrond is not mean to the dwarves or anything, but he's sort of questioning, should you be doing this?
Mm-hmm.
And they have to sneak out.
Yeah, there's also because all the stuff with the White Council, I thought it was really interesting how they brought in the Morgul Blade, and they had all the stuff with talking about the Witch King. I'm pretty sure they made up. Like, I'm not a Tolkien expert, but I don't remember any of the stuff. I was like, he has this tomb and everything. Like, I remember the Nazgul having gone off and just being sort of like these withered, weakened creatures, like in Minas Morgul, and not necessarily they're like in these tombs and all that stuff. But it was really cool to see, you know, they unwrap it and it's like you've got the Morgul knife. And it's like, yeah,
that thing's gonna stab the shit out of Frodo.
Yeah, it's like the Witch King's coming, bitch.
Yes, so a lot of good stuff there. And again, like I said, once they leave Rivendell, that's when the movie completely clicks for me, and it just gets really good, because I think this is also where we get probably the best action scene up to this point, which is the rock monsters.
Oh, yeah. I was really curious whether or not they were actually going to do the giants, because it's kind of a slightly ambiguous whether or not they're really used more of as a metaphor in the book or not, because giants are never mentioned again in Lord of the Rings, like anywhere else. Really fucking cool that they're like, yeah, no, fuck it. We're going to put the giants in here, and we're going to make them, like, this really significant threat now, instead of just like, we should get in this cave because there are giants over there. It's like, we're standing on one of the giants right now. This is not a good idea.
I'll say this, that is one of the most sort of creative and just inventive action scenes I think I've ever seen. It's just really creative, how the camera moves, and just everything about it. There's just so much going on, and I love sort of the strategy of it, of having to figure out, how do we get off these things?
Yeah, exactly. It puts you in all of a sudden you're in this very, like, weird, unorthodox situation, and that you were not expecting that. Even I wasn't expecting this, because I didn't, I thought they might put the giants in there, but I did not expect them to make it such a big part. So as soon as suddenly they're like in there, I'm like, oh, this is kind of different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, we have some complaints about how they use CGI in this movie, and we'll talk about that later, but this is an example of using CGI really well.
Yeah.
I think.
So it's actually kind of interesting. Parts of the CGI almost kind of look stop motion-y to me.
Yeah.
There's something about how they did, like, the way they moved.
It's really well done.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So then they get into the cave, and we have one of my favorite scenes in the movie, which is Bilbo sort of having lost hope, and he decides he's going to leave. And Bofur, who is probably my favorite dwarf in this movie, I love how they do Bofur, he has this very heartfelt exchange with Bilbo where you realize, for all the fun Bofur has made of him, Bofur kind of loves Bilbo. He doesn't want him to leave. They're friends. And
and
I love that Bilbo sort of realizes, like, that alone makes Bilbo start to think, like, well, maybe I do have a place here. And that's sort of, that's the kickoff of his arc for the last act of the movie. And then, of course, they get sucked in.
Down to Goblin Town.
Yep.
Oh, my life.
Do you like how the goblins have kind of an elaborate trap system?
Yeah, they've got this, like, weird, like, where the floor opens up and then you kind of, like, see that it's got, like, these, like, wooden panels and stuff. Yeah, I like that it's not just this weird, and then the stones, like, broke open and goblins started pouring out. It's like, how the fuck did they do that? And they're kind of like, oh, okay, they have this.
Yeah.
It's a very specific trap, but, you know.
It works. And here's a decision that I think really works well, is they fall down and the dwarves get taken, Bilbo kind of runs away, and once the dwarves get taken, then we go back to Bilbo, and we pretty much, after he falls down, I think there's one scene with the Goblin King where we kind of introduce him and some of that, but then Bilbo falls down, and we get into Riddles of the Dark, and I love that they do the whole scene without cutting away. They just, they realize this is important, this is all about Bilbo, and for the next 20 minutes of this movie, we are on him, and the focus of that works really well.
Yeah.
And so I think it's time to talk about the best scene in the movie to me, which is Riddles in the Dark.
Yeah, I
which
agree.
They fucking nailed. This is like, I can't even believe they did this scene this well, because not that I don't ever doubt it would be a great scene, but just it's on another level even to me than what it is in the book. Like, it's really compelling here.
I like the book version more,
okay.
But you know, it's like my favorite chapter in anything ever. So
yeah,
I don't think any film scene could ever be as good as the book scene to me,
okay.
But
it's just, it's really compelling to me, and I think they took something that is not inherently cinematic and made it really exciting.
Yeah.
And obviously, Andy Serkis is so good.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah. I think they took a lot of pains to make Gollum seem a lot more threatening than he's portrayed in that scene in the book,
yeah.
And that really helps make the scene feel alive.
And it also helps you to realize how smart Bilbo is, because what Bilbo's having to deal with is that the Schmeagol Gollum personas are, he's very schizophrenic in this scene.
Yeah.
And he realizes very quickly, okay, one side of this creature is just sort of stupid and crazy, but docile.
Yeah.
But the other side wants to eat me.
Mm-hmm.
So how do I have to play to the docile side. And so that's where the riddle game comes out of. So they sort of give a little more context to why Bilbo goes into the riddle game.
Mm-hmm.
And that he's very clever in how he does it. And again, giving Bilbo a little more agency works very well here. But, man, just the two play. I mean, Martin Freeman and Andy Serkis, they really play off each other well.
Mm-hmm.
They have great chemistry. And just the whole scene plays really well. I love the design of the cave. And I love sort of how light is always bouncing off them from the lake.
Yeah.
I love that we have Gollum's little boat in there for a shot.
Yeah.
Not enough little boat, but some little boat.
I was disappointed that there was no scene where Gollum goes into his hut and just like throwing junk out cartoon style. But
We do have the great scene where he's trying to guess what's in Bilbo's pocket, and he's going through all these things that only matter to Gollum, like fish heads and bones and fingers. So, no, I think it's really good, and I think it's interesting how, again, just the focus of the scene, it happens in real time. We're watching their conversation. We go through each riddle. I don't think every riddle from the book is there, but a lot of them are.
No, there aren't all of them.
But a lot of them are, and I think they do good...
They do the best ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I like how they read them back and forth with each other, and I love the moment where Gollum takes over during the riddle game and just kind of disappears, and he's a disembodied voice. And Martin Freeman, really, he plays this scene damn good, where Bilbo is both showing his courage and understandably being pretty freaked out.
Yeah.
Because there's this crazy fucking weird goblin-y kind of thing. And
you don't know what the fuck it is, and now it's stalking you. Yeah.
Here's another point that I thought was interesting, is I like that they showed Gollum dropping the ring.
Oh, yeah.
Because
I
think, because this has to be the Gollum from Lord of the Rings, basically. And because because this movie is coming after the Lord of the Rings trilogy in terms of release, we know Gollum very well.
Yeah.
And we know he wouldn't just leave the ring, he would notice pretty soon. So it makes more sense to actually see him drop it than for Bilbo to just stumble upon it.
Although it does make it really weird where the fuck in that loincloth does he keep the
ring?
That bugged me to no end, where it's like, is it just like, did he sort of like just stick it in between like the strap in his skin? Like, there's no pockets on a loincloth, man.
Do you like that he's been wearing the same loincloth for 60 years? That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's a good point. But, like, it kind of gets you the feeling that he came in there with a pair of pants, and that, like, that's what's left of the pants at this point, and he's just still wearing it. He just never took his pants off.
Very much so.
Yeah, that was just, like, a weird little... Because they did show you him dropping the ring, but it's sort of like the ring just sort of, like, flies out of his loincloth. It's like... That's kind of weird. And then later when he's looking for his ring, he's like, looks like he's checking his pockets, but he's just like patting his loincloth. I'm like, do you think you would notice if this like piece of metal was not on your loincloth somewhere?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll see it again and look. Like, is there, maybe they added
a little... Because I realized it at a point where I could no longer like try to look to see where he was keeping it.
Yes, so we'll look and maybe report on that again.
Yeah.
In any case,
I know, where the fuck does Gollum keep his ring? We don't want to know the answer to that.
Yeah, though. I want to finish talking about the whole Bilbo and Gollum side of this story before sort of doubling back to talk about the dwarves. So there is a cut after the riddle game ends, back to the dwarves and sort of their whole action sequence. But I really like also after the riddle's in the dark how they handle Bilbo's escape and all the stuff with Gollum. I think it's really exciting. It's very tense.
Yeah.
And I especially love, A, how they depict invisibility in this film, because they obviously have to tone it down from what it was in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, because Sauron's not like this overbearing presence right now.
Right. And it has to be something reasonable where Bilbo could keep that on for long periods of time, because he does in the story. But then also, I think the way they depict Bilbo choosing to spare Gollum's life is, it hits you.
They really emphasize that point, and... Like, and it makes you think towards in Fellowship when Gandalf and Frodo have that conversation.
Yeah.
That, like, you know, you get to see that moment now. And they really emphasize, they put the proper emphasis on it that's not really, like, there in the book.
And Andy Serkis is really good at just non-verbally showing that, for all of Gollum's flaws, he's not a horrible person. And he does feel these things like sadness and grief and longing. And you realize he's more a victim than anything else.
Yeah, yeah. What he does isn't his fault because he's a slave to the ring. And so, you know, and that moment is really, really well done.
Yeah.
And then I do have to say, I thought it was kind of weird how Bilbo getting the ring on his finger the first time is like the same thing that happens to Frodo in The Green Dragon.
That felt inevitable that they were going to do that to me, though.
Yeah, but it was like, I don't know. It felt kind of like... I don't know why you had to do it that way. I don't know why he couldn't have, like, just put on the ring the first time he found it, like, and kind of realized he was invisible, and then, like, I don't know. It's like,
I just think this was more cinematic than...
Yeah, but it just kind of stood out to me as being a weird way for that to happen. Because it's weird when it happens in Fellowship anyways. It's like, it works okay in a book, but when you see actually a ring go flying and then it falls onto your fingers, like, there's no... That wouldn't happen! Like, there's no fucking way a ring goes flying into the air and then you're, like, trying to grab it and it ends up falling onto your finger. Like, that makes no fucking sense. Right. It's a total nitpick, but it's something that kind of bugged me.
Yeah. So let's go back and talk about...
It's like Gollum pockets.
So let's go talk back and talk about the dwarves. They meet King Goblin, who has an interesting design.
That's one way to describe it, yeah.
He's got a giant ball sack for a chin.
Yeah. And he's, like, really huge and fat and,
I like the Goblin King. You didn't?
Yeah, I thought the design was really weird and out of place.
Okay.
I think all the designs, it made the CGI really stand out to me, particularly because also the designs of the orcs and goblins, which should be the same thing, but I don't know how they're defining them in this movie now, but it made it stand out to me that they are not the same designs as in the Lord of the Rings movies, which seems like a weird choice to make, because...
Yeah.
Why?
And I think we'll talk about this later when we get into CGI and design and all these things. But in any case, did you like the scenes?
I mean, I liked the Goblin King as a character. I just, his design stood out to me. The CGI stood out to me so much that I couldn't get into his character.
Okay.
I think if they had made him so, like, ludicrously fat and sort of over the top, it, like, visually, it would have made the acting a lot more acceptable for me.
Yeah. But what about sort of just the scenes themselves of the dwarves being prisoner and then Gandalf coming to rescue them?
Yeah, I thought all that was... I thought, like, Gandalf just, like, sort of, like, popping out of nowhere was really fucking cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Deus Ex Gandalf.
Yeah, first of all. He's a fucking demigod. He can do it if he wants to.
But I like sort of the attitudes of the dwarves here. And then when we... I always like seeing the dwarves in action in this movie, because they gave a lot of thought to how each of them fight individually.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some fun fighting stuff there. And then we get the... It's a cool chase sequence, even if it's a little over the top. I do like the escape from the dungeon. No, I guess they're not dungeons, but the
cave. From the caverns.
I agree there are some violence things there where, like, do we really need Gandalf beheading and then knocking the head off?
Yeah, and it's like having this cute little moment after he decapitates a goblin. Because, again, having the Goblin King being this talking, interacting character where, you know he feels confidence, he feels fear. Like, having him be an actual character and then having all those other goblins there, it's like it makes it really stand out to me, the fact that now all of a sudden they're just killing all of them. It just sort of bothers me that it's like... I don't know. There's something really weird about having this really cute moment about cutting off a character's head. That's not just this, like, what you've made out to just be a monster anymore.
Yeah. And it also
a few moments like that actually see this, like, jeez.
It's when you think about it, that's a sadistic thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, that's, like, you cut off this dude's head, and it's like, it doesn't quite fall off yet, so you have this little smirk, and then you knock it off with your staff. Like, what the fuck kind of person are you?
You have to wonder, has Gandalf done that before?
I mean, he's like 2,000 years old, so probably, but it's like...
Should Gandalf do that?
No?
Yeah.
I don't think so. It doesn't make him feel particularly heroic anymore. Where he's just... He has this, like, glee when he does it. It's like, what the fuck, man? Dude. Then he cuts open, like, the Goblin King's belly, and that's just like, fuck, man.
That'll do it.
Yep. Yeah, that was like, no, that was dumb. Don't.
Sorry.
That line, like, having him joke. Like, all, like, the way it ended, where it's like he's joking, and then they all fall down, and then the Goblin King's fat corpse falls on them. It's like, then what I think is Dwalin's like, this, you've got to be joking! I'm like, yeah, that was a dumb joke.
Okay.
Having the sort of, like, those moments of slapstick, and, like, having this, like, dumb joke where the Goblin King's like, well, that'll do it. Made, and, like, interacting with this really... graphic violence, like that scene in particular felt really tonally imbalanced to me in a way that bugged me.
But overall, we agree this stretch of the movie is compelling and fun.
Yeah,
I think
it's really compelling. It's just like the tonal issues stand out in that moment. But then also, they do have a lot of really good, like, action moments in there where they're like on the bridge. They get pretty creative with the action where they're not just running around cutting people down. They have some nice moments there because they're all trying to escape.
Yes.
Yeah.
Although, again, some of it's kind of when you start to think about it, it's like, they're mass murderers. Like, when I think it's Dwalin again, gets this big stick, and he's just, like, banging goblins off on both sides. It's like, that's a lot of people to kill.
Yeah.
And the goblins are kind
of... At the very least, he's not, you know, like, fucking stabbing their heads off and shit like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In any case, they escape, they get to the forest, Bilbo joins up with them, and... one of the very best scenes in the movie of Bilbo takes the ring off and he says, I know you doubt me. And he gives this whole spiel about, I do dream of Bag End. That is my home. But you don't have a home. And I'm going to help you get it.
Yeah.
And damn it, if they did not nail the heart of this book in that scene to me. Just,
that was my favorite scene in the whole movie. And it solved, I don't really want to call it an issue because it's like a very deliberate decision. But it something about the movie up to that point had really indicated to me the fact that Bilbo has no reason to be there in a way that the book never did, just because, you know, it's a children's book and you sort of go along with it. But having it, you know, to be all these characters and, like, this really well-fleshed out three-dimensional Bilbo and Thorin being a fucking asshole to Bilbo all the time and, like, why the fuck are you here? But it is like, why the fuck is Bilbo here? He has no reason to be there. And I think Bilbo doesn't understand why he's there up to that point. And, like, having that scene in that moment really sort of, it sort of solidified why Bilbo's there, and it really sort of made the movie tie together to me. That was definitely that was my favorite moment in the whole movie.
I agree, and it arcs so nicely.
Yeah.
Where you really do, they really do account for the idea that, well, why is Bilbo here? And then he goes on this, the whole cave scene with him and Gollum, I like that they really emphasize that the riddles in the dark and his whole experience, that really makes him start to consider his role and what he is there for. And that when he gets back, he could very easily leave. He's gotten the ring. He has, that's the key moment, is that he has a choice.
Yeah.
And he chooses to stay. And he gives a very nice speech. Martin Freeman is brilliant in that scene. And it's very good. And then we get into, I think, what is a fantastic action climax for the movie, which is the out of the frying pan into the fire. Were you okay that they name dropped the chapter?
Yeah.
Okay, I was okay.
Yeah.
It was.
I was a little disappointed that the orcs didn't start saying like 15 birds and 5 fir trees.
Wouldn't that be funny if Azog turned out? Had a
He's got this really deep, really like baritone, like really nice singing voice. 15 birds, 5 fir trees. That would have been awesome. I have to say, ever since we did that podcast, that song has been stuck in my head. But I don't know why, because I can only remember that part of the song. It's been stuck in my head fucking forever. That and Goblin Town. Down to Goblin Town.
They were stuck in my head for a couple of days, too.
Yes, goddamn. It's like, and then, like, and they kind of left, and then when I was watching the movie, like the Peter Jackson movie, I was like, I don't know, I'm remembering the songs now again.
I did. When I watched An Unexpected Journey the second time, I did keep flashing back to the animated movie and like how they did it, and I'm like, man, these are very different.
Yeah, these are completely different adaptations, although weirdly both of them don't have Gandalf beating the trolls.
Yeah. There's a weird place for them to kind of line up.
Yeah.
In any case, what were we talking about? So the out of the
15 birds and 5 for trees.
Yes.
Even though there's only one tree in this
right.
one that they all get into.
But, man, I think it's just really well done. It's very inventive, and I love how much, I mean, I know they live, but I was kind of scared when they're hanging off the tree, and it's like just the sense of size and scope. Again, great cinematography, great location for this all to be happening.
Yeah.
And the orc designs are pretty, you know, fearsome. I like the wargs. And then we get maybe the most badass scene I have seen in a movie in a long time of they're all on the tree, it seems hopeless, and even though it's hopeless, Thorin sees Azog, and he's just like, fuck it. And he stands up, and Howard Shore knows exactly how to score that scene.
Yeah.
And it's just like pounding drums, and Thorin gets up, and he, you know, runs over, he gets his fucking oaken shield, and he runs up to Azog, and he knows he's fucked. But he's like, I don't care, I have to do this.
Yeah.
And that's awesome, and it gets really sad, because you're like, oh, fuck, Thorin's just, he's got beat up, he's going to get his head chopped off. And then it gets even more awesome, because Bilbo decides, I'm going to be a hero, and Bilbo
I'm going to kill a motherfucker.
Yeah.
Like, the moment where Bilbo, like, I do, like, it felt like they understood how important was the fact that Bilbo does need to end up killing a goblin at some point.
Yeah.
And they put the proper emphasis on that moment where it's like, it feels pretty fucking brutal when he does it.
Yeah. And it's like Bilbo shocks himself because he stabs and it's like, oh, I just took a life.
Yeah.
But that's a scene where it's well justified.
Yeah. And it's going to, I'm glad that they managed to like sort of get and like jump that hurdle in this movie where it'll make it feel a little more appropriate when Bilbo is actually like doing some more action stuff in 2 and 3.
Very much so. So, just the whole way that wraps up, and then once Bilbo showed his heroism, it sort of inspires the other dwarves to all come out, and we get another good fight, and it's just, it's very satisfying, and the eagle's coming. It's just, that's just another scene where I feel like they nailed it, and to me, that scene enhances how it plays in the book.
Yeah, I agree. It's mostly because you have this nice thing between Thorin and Azog, where Thorin has this motivation where he wants to go kill that motherfucker, because he killed his grandfather. And caused his father to kind of go insane. And, yeah, they have that motivation there and having, you know, Richard Armitage being able to be a complete fucking badass.
Yes.
Yeah, it makes that scene a lot more effective than it is in the book, where it feels a little bit weird that you have the goblin thing, and then you get out, and then you have this thing again.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, we get it. They're killing goblins.
And then last scenes of the movie, I really, obviously there's some more gorgeous cinematography of them flying with the eagles across New Zealand.
Yeah.
And they get to that peak, and I was glad someone in, like, the CGI department at Weta did something very smart, where when they land on that peak, they animated stairs on the peak.
Yeah.
So, because if they didn't do that, it would make the eagles look like assholes.
Yeah, because it's like, oh, we need to hike off of this fucking thing? Like, goddamn.
That would be the first half hour of the next movie. Yeah,
Biffer, did you bring the climbing hooks? We need to get off the fucking mountain. Thanks a lot, Gwaihir, asshole.
But it's a cool place for them to end the movie.
Yeah.
Some nice dialogue there. And I've seen sort of some mixed reactions on how they play the Thorin Bilbo stuff here, but it works really. I know it's cliched, sort of this
kind of. Yeah, the whole, like, he starts off talking where it's like implying that he's really mad at Bilbo. And then it's like, no, he actually loves Bilbo.
But I like it.
I like it too, but it does feel a bit cliche. Like, I feel like I've seen that moment so many times in movies.
But it's a cliche done beautifully to me. And I think it works really well. And I like Bilbo admitting, like, you know, I would have doubted me too, but I'm here now. And
I love you too, Thorin.
Yes.
And then they hug it out.
Yep. And Thorin says, Bilbo, "This has really been an unexpected journey." And Bilbo says, "You said it, buddy." They don't really do that.
Yeah, no.
But we do get the nice little line from Bilbo to end the movie of, "I think the worst is behind us."
Yeah, I thought that was really funny.
Because that's another line that could have gone wrong, but because of how intense this was, it feels appropriate.
Yeah, and it's... I think it's just because Martin Freeman's so fucking good. He's like,
yeah.
any line he can nail.
He can sell,
movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that works.
And it does sort of put you in this weird place because you as the audience knows there's two more movies.
You're not
even close.
I've
read the book. You're not even close to the worst being behind you. But from Bilbo's perspective, it totally would make sense why he would think that.
Yeah.
Because...
he's an optimist.
Yeah, and why would he expect that they're going to go through something more awful than having to, like, run through all that, like, the goblin shit?
Yeah.
Other than Smaug, it seems kind of stupid for him to, like, not recognize the fact that there's a dragon waiting for them at the end of the journey, but...
it's selective memory. I mean,
yeah.
He's been through some shit.
Yeah.
So, but then we get another great shot where we sort of pan out to the Lonely Mountain, and again... those locations in New Zealand they found for these areas are perfect.
Yeah.
The location scouts in these movies, they deserve... someone buy them a drink.
Yeah.
What they're doing.
I'm sure someone has at some point in
their
life, but...
in any case...
that
mountain
looked really lonely.
It did.
Yeah.
And then we get into Erebor, and we see a little shot of Smaug. How did you like this as the end of the movie?
I liked it a lot. Yeah, I thought it was a nice little teaser.
Yep.
Getting you pumped up for the next one. And then I also like how, for the credits... Benedict Cumberbatch is in the credits. He's the voice of Smaug, and I was like, "Why is he? Oh, was he doing like all like the little Smaug growls like at the very end?" Which is like, whoosh. It's like it just put me in like Sherlock Holmes in like a VO booth,
yeah.
Like growling into a microphone.
It could also be that he's going to play the Necromancer too,
yeah.
And if that shadow, I don't, maybe he mocapped the shadow. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows.
Or it was just, it's more like...
yeah, it might
have
just run, yeah.
It's his contract and he's...
yeah, yeah,
yeah,
but I don't know. It made me think about it.
Yeah.
It was a nice visual image.
Yes, so... and that's the story of the movie. So, on the whole, we're pretty happy with how they're adapting this so far.
Yeah, yeah. It makes me... the best thing I can say about this movie is that it makes me super excited to see the other ones and what they do with those.
And I definitely want to talk about that now because I think... I totally agree because, well, again, had some structure issues... the movie coalesces around Bilbo and his arc so well during the last act, and it's so satisfying. And I know everything they're going to be covering in film 2 is all Bilbo-centric, pretty much.
Yeah, other than the...
Bard the Bowman and...
And they raid Dol Guldur. I imagine that's going to be the second
movie. Right. But they can do multiple climaxes with
that.
That'll be fine. But it's very much like this is... Bilbo now has agency, and he has agency in the book, too. So for now, it's like
and
they can really hit
Bilbo's
it hard.
Bilbo's taken a life, man.
Yes.
He don't come back from that. He
right.
gets like his like tattoo with like the blood drop tear.
Yes.
He's murdered somebody now.
That'll be how the next movie opens. Dwalin will...
yeah, it's just like Martin Freeman with his shirt off. It's like a tattoo. You're one of us now, Bilbo.
And he's got a 15.
Yeah.
Or 14, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, no, I'm definitely excited because my favorite part of The Hobbit, the book, is what we're covering in film 2. And they have more than enough to cover for a whole movie next time because there's a lot before they even get to Smaug. But then all the stuff with Smaug, is if you do it in the right amount of detail, which they did here, there's a lot to do.
Yeah,
like,
I'm so excited to see the scene with Bilbo and Smaug.
Yes.
Just how fucking awesome Martin Freeman is as Bilbo.
And we know how good the actor doing Smaug is.
Yeah.
So, and we know those two... They happen to have chemistry.
Yeah.
They've worked together.
Like, I wonder when, like, the next season of Sherlock comes around, if they're going to have to make... like, it feels like you're going to have to make some sort of joke about, like, outside reference to that in some way.
Like
I couldn't... if I had, like, wrote an episode of that show, I couldn't avoid it. Like,
I know.
There's no possible way you could avoid that.
It's like, Sherlock, you're being angry as a dragon today.
Okay, maybe not something quite like that.
Hey, short notice.
Like, my dear Watson... your feet look a bit hairy today.
Why would he be... okay, never mind.
They live in the same flat!
That's true.
It's like he's seen Watson without his shoes off before.
I get it. I know. All right. So, we are very excited for the next season of Sherlock. But we're talking about The Hobbit. Which we're even more excited for. Next movie of The Hobbit. So,
yeah.
Too bad we have to wait a year, but I'm sure it will be good.
Yeah.
And I hope they, they spend the time making a damn good movie.
Yeah, and also
finishing a damn
we'll
movie.
Get the extra 25 minutes for the extended edition to tide us over at some point.
Definitely. I'm very excited for that. So, I mean, I guess that's a question to ask now since we're still on story. Do you see openings where you're excited to see extended material?
I think just more stuff in Rivendell, obviously, is going to be there.
I also want, honestly, a little more at the beginning in Bag End before the dwarves start arriving. Because I would have liked just a scene between Bilbo and Gandalf meeting and then that night. And I know they shot some stuff because there's this journalist at Ain't It Cool News who he was on the set and did a cameo during that time period and his scene got cut. But I guess that is going to be an extended cut. Just a little more of like, I want to see how Bilbo operates in Hobbit culture.
Yeah.
So, not like a burning, like, this movie sucks because it's not there, but if we're going to get it, I'd like to see it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I definitely like that the extended cut is like 20 to 25 minutes longer. I think if you went any further, that would be a mistake, because this movie does not need to be like 4 hours long.
Yeah, yeah. So, this movie might be a bit too long for some people.
Yeah.
I think if you don't have a really deep fondness for Lord of the Rings, some of the slower pacing of the movie would probably stand out a lot more to you, I feel.
Right. So in any case, that's sort of the story and the adaptation. I think we've said everything we need to say about that. Mm-hmm. So I think now we should talk about characters.
Okay.
And we've hinted at, we've talked a little bit about this before, how much we love Martin Freeman at Bilbo, but let's get into it. Sean, tell us about why Martin Freeman is a great Bilbo.
I think it's just sort of all of Martin Freeman's sort of roles feel like...
they're from that archetype.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Martin Freeman just feels like the perfect guy to play Bilbo, where he's got that sort of everyman appeal, and he's able to deliver that really natural, lighthearted humor that's sort of a little bit, you know, self-deprecating and stuff like that. That there's just something so perfect about Martin Freeman's Bilbo that's really hard to describe. But he's, I mean, I have to say, honestly, I need to obviously watch the other movies, but I feel Martin Freeman is so fucking good as Bilbo, he might be my favorite casting in, like, any of these Lord of the Rings movies. Like, he's, like, really? There with, like, Ian McKellen as Gandalf. It's so fucking good.
Yeah. And, you know, I definitely need to see more of him in future movies. Not to decide whether he's good or not. I want to see more of him because he's really good. Before maybe I see...
And see how, like, he handles some of, like, the darker stuff. Yeah. Like, did really big, important plot stuff.
But what's impressive about him here to me is that, as you just said, he's just perfect casting no matter what. But it's not just the casting. I think his performance here, he goes beyond what he's done before. He really... I like how he's able to portray Bilbo's cowardice at parts. And his sort of his shame and his sort of like his longing for home, because these are beats that I don't know if Freeman has played in any other movie. Arthur Dent is obviously similar, but even then, Arthur Dent he never gets to the level of Bilbo as hero in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So I think Martin Freeman has to play sort of a wider range of arc.
Yeah.
And he's very good at it. And he also he feels like a hobbit, and he feels like...
Yeah, and that was one of the things that I thought maybe would make his performance not work as well, is that he's so fucking good as the everyman, that having him be in a fantasy movie at first kind of seemed like, that might be a little bit weird. It works perfectly. Like, he just...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's... While we say that he kind of is, like, always in this archetype, he's not, like... being like he's not just a Martin Freeman character here. He is Bilbo. Like, this is a very distinct, well thought out, three dimensional character that he has created, and it's Bilbo on screen, not Martin Freeman every moment.
Yeah,
yeah.
And you know, I will say because we don't spend as much time with Bilbo here as probably I would have loved. I don't know if I would say right at this moment I am quite as taken with him as I always have been with, like, Elijah Wood as Frodo, who always felt immediately perfect to me too. But I think they're definitely of a piece together, and that they've gotten the perfect Bilbo and the perfect Frodo in these movies is awesome.
Yeah.
And it's too bad they'll never get to interact.
Yeah, I know. I had that thought the other day too.
Not that Ian Holm is any... I mean, Ian Holm's perfect also.
Yeah, as older Bilbo, but there needs to be some, like, weird crossover, I don't know, thing. That's, again, you know, just they should just make a short film. Put it on one of the extended edition DVDs. It's like Bilbo and Frodo, like Martin Freeman, Bilbo, and Elijah Wood, Frodo, just like fucking some shit up.
Yeah.
Like going around having like a party on the town or something. You bring Sam, Merry, and Pippin along too.
That'd be great. Merry and Pippin would be kind of the ringleaders of that.
Yeah, like Bilbo travels into the future. He just like has a party with them one night.
Yeah. When they're like young hobbits, rowdy teenagers.
Yeah.
Or I guess they would be in like their 30s, but still.
They cruise around the Shire, pick up some bitches. Yeah.
Rosie, come on! It'd be great. No, Martin Freeman is sublime. And that's more than anything, that's why I want to see film 2, because that's where Bilbo is really the hero.
Yeah.
And it's going to be so awesome, especially the Smaug scene, like you said, because that's Bilbo being just all kinds of awesome. And Martin Freeman he gets this character, and I think he's taken this chance to be in the spotlight and gone as far with it as any person could.
Mm-hmm.
And he's great. And, you know, if there's more with just him in the extended cut, that'll justify the extended cut.
Yeah.
He's good.
It's really goddamn good.
I think we should also mention he looks the part. I mean, when you look at him, it's like, yeah, that's how Bilbo looks.
Yep.
Just they've, and it's partially because they've done good makeup and hair, the, like the wig and the feet, it all looks good. And his, I love his costume in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But just definitely, he just he holds it the way he holds himself, the way he looks. He's a very, very, very great Bilbo.
Yeah, I agree. Maybe not quite up there with the animated Bilbo, though. The animated Bilbo...
Who doesn't give a shit about anything?
Like, vacant, like, slightly high appearance. Just completely stilted, nonchalant attitude. He's just like, I'm just going to fuck around with the dragon today.
Yep.
That's the Bilbo I know and love.
All right. So, let's talk about Gandalf. I don't know if there's much to say, because this is Ian McKellen, and he's as good as he's ever been.
Yeah, it's more, it's definitely, you know, it's Gandalf the Grey, which definitely feels like a specific character away from the white,
and it's so
nice to have more of that.
It is, and it's nice to have Gandalf where they really recognize that he's a dynamic character at this point in his life, and they've written him very well here. Ian McKellen plays him beautifully, he's got lots more great dialogue to deliver. This is still one of the best performances ever, and...
Yeah, and it particularly stands out to me in the White Council scene, just because... Having him interact with those characters in that way is a very different dynamic for Gandalf, where, you know, he's with his buddy Elrond, and Elrond isn't kind of mad at him because of, like, all the shit going on with the War of the Ring, and it's like he's with Galadriel, who he's never been able to interact with, he's with Saruman on a sort of, like, friendly basis. It's like, having all that dynamic is really interesting, and Ian McKellen plays it off really magnificently.
And while we're on those characters, just the returning cast members really quick, Hugo Weaving... I really like that Hugo Weaving was able to do a lighter, happier Elrond.
Yeah, that he doesn't have, like, the weight of the world on his shoulders right now. He's just able to kind of, like, hang out and chill.
It just felt right. Like, that's just, like, that's Elrond at this point in his life. Really, really, really well done.
It's, like, it gives Rivendell's name as, like, the last homely house. This, like, I get that more, I get that feeling now as opposed to, like, in Lord of the Rings, it's like... And Elrond was not so happy to have people around in Lord of the Rings,
right?
Understandably.
I really like the just little touches in Rivendell in this movie where they've got musicians and harp players. Just that's what Rivendell is like at this time.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do a song, but they don't need to. While they're running from wargs, they sing the elf song. Anyway, so the other returning people in that scene would be Christopher Lee, who is still awesome.
Yep, although I just kind of feeling his age at this point, you know, Christopher Lee's... Yeah,
you can't blame him.
Yeah, no. He's still fucking Christopher Lee, but it's like it was definitely noticeable that he's older now than you know. Obviously, he was like 10 years ago.
And I guess that also just makes me glad that he was able to do a role like this one last time because I this is so macabre of me to say it, and I hate to say it. He's not going to be with us, you know, probably for too much longer.
He's
very old.
Yeah, and it was cool to see him back in the white robe.
Yep, and hopefully he'll be in... I don't know how they're utilizing him, if at all, in the next two, but...
I mean, cool. I would imagine he would at least be in the next one to deal with some of the Dol Guldur stuff.
Yes.
But yeah.
And finally, we already mentioned how good Cate Blanchett is here, and if anything, she's even better.
Yeah, I think just because she has a... It's just a better scene for her. Although, I mean, the Mirror of Galadriel scene in Fellowship is really, really awesome.
Yeah.
But, like, there's something about... Her being, like, interacting with these other, like, mythical, powerful people in Middle-earth really allows her to stand out.
She's also the only woman in this entire movie.
She's enough woman for the whole movie.
She very much is. She is, And she, it's funny, she does not look like she's aged a day.
Yeah. I think she might actually be an elf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's fucking beautiful.
Yeah. But I don't know, there's something about, I love how you get the sense of, like, Galadriel is somehow, like, this, like, immensely kind and benevolent being, but she's also, like, fucking terrifying.
Yes.
This, I don't know how they're able to strike that balance so well, but
I'd like to see if she's involved in Dol Guldur, if they could really do even more with that.
She just, like, fucks shit up. She goes in just, like, with, like, two swords and just starts killing people.
I was gonna say she fires the Kamehameha.
Yeah, no. She.
Just kidding.
Yeah.
All right.
She's a spirit bomb kind of girl.
Alright, I think so too. So... Okay, so those are the returning people. Just wanted to get them out of the way quickly. So now, let's talk about the whole gaggle of dwarves.
Yeah.
But we have to start with the most important dwarf of them all, Thorin Oakenshield.
Oh, I thought it was Ori.
Richard Armitage. On a scale of 1 to fuck yeah, how awesome is Richard Armitage?
Fuck yeah! Dude, Thorin is so fucking badass in this movie.
He's awesome. And we kind of talked about this before. We could tell from the trailers, like, that looks like the right casting. But when you actually see him in action here, they really got that right.
Yeah. Thorin's fucking awesome.
He really is.
Yeah.
And I like that they really keep in mind something that Tolkien had sort of in the last part of the Hobbit book, which is that Thorin is a dynamic, complicated, and very flawed character.
Yeah, he's very arrogant and stubborn. He's very much a dwarf.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm excited to see him even more in films 2 and 3, especially 3.
Yeah, where they have to deal with now that he has his home back. And him, like,
you his know, kind of tragic downfall.
Yeah, and him causing basically the War of the Five Armies and all that stuff. Yeah.
It's going to be really dynamic, and especially because they spent film one so heavily establishing that he and Bilbo become really good friends, and they mean a lot to each other, and eventually.
But Thorin has some really deep seated issues that he's kind of. Has to deal with.
I mean, they do a great... Even if I feel sometimes the balance is sort of off in Thorin's... It's, like, almost too much in Thorin's favor sometimes in this movie. What we get of Thorin is, like, it's just... He's a very, very compelling character.
Yeah.
And Richard Armitage... It's not just that he's badass and that he's physically imposing and that every time he, you know, raises an eye, it's like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
He just looks like he's always ready for action.
He just has this really commanding screen presence that's really impressive. It makes you feel like he's like this king.
Yes.
They even when, you know, I think it really stood out in Rivendell where, you know, they kind of come in and they're dirty, they're sort of battered and beaten. And Elrond comes in and Elrond's just like, you know, he's really majestic. He's got these robes on even though he was just in a battle. And then sort of Thorin steps out of the group and it's like, Thorin still, even like that, Thorin still feels like he's sort of on the level of Elrond, that he is this ruler and this sort of this king.
Absolutely. And I think it would be hard for any actor to capture that. So Richard Armitage, great job. And I'd like to see more of his work because I've never seen this guy in anything.
Yeah.
He's obviously a very talented actor. So obviously they've kind of positioned him as this movie's Viggo Mortensen, and it works very well.
Yeah. I mean, and actually in a weird sort of way, a lot of his dynamic feels a little bit more like book Aragorn to me.
It does.
Yeah, where he has that very, like, kingly presence from the very start, and that sort of, like, I'm going to reclaim my throne sort of attitude. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, but more interesting because
he still has that dynamism that comes from his issues with, like, you know, his father, his grandfather being killed, and his immense amount of pride around his heritage.
And I like all the things we sort of hear, like, with him and Balin talking, with Balin saying, you know, you've built a great home for us, we respect you, and you get this sense of time that Thorin has been around a long time, and he's worked his whole life just for his people.
Yeah.
And he's a really good character, and I want to see more of him.
Yeah.
So, as for the other dwarves, we're not going to talk about each one of them individually. I do want to hit a couple of them. But for the most part, I think, just as a unit, I am really overjoyed with how they did the dwarves in this movie. I think they did as good a job as anyone could do.
Yeah.
Not every dwarf is obviously a distinct, three-dimensional, like, really complex character. You could never do that. At least not in one movie. I do think by the end of the third, we may know all of them a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
But as for just as a unit, for one, they feel very diverse and very sort of they're very thoughtful in both their design, execution, and performance.
Yeah.
So each dwarf looks different. Each dwarf sounds different. Each dwarf sort of fights a little differently. They all use a different kind of weapon.
Yeah.
They all talk a little differently. You definitely feel like this is a diverse group of dwarves. But at the same time, the sense of dwarf culture is really strong. Like, I like that they've taken basically all the John Rhys-Davies stuff from as Gimli from Lord of the Rings and used that kind of as a foundation to sort of extrapolate exponentially. Mm-hmm. So they still kind of have this Scottish edge to them, where a lot of them say things like laddie.
Yeah.
And whatnot.
Dwalin in particular has a really strong Scottish accent.
Yeah. Well, that's Graham McTavish. He's very Scottish. Mm-hmm. But, I really like how they did the dwarves. And I think even the dwarves that are not characterized in very much detail, like Gloin, for instance, Gloin has one line in the movie, and that's when he sort of, like, berates Elrond. Mm-hmm. But when you see Gloin, you feel like, yeah, that's Gloin. That is a character. That's not just another dwarf. That's a person. And whether we see more of them or not, it's just every time you see one of the individual dwarves in this movie, they feel like a real character, and the more time you spend with them as a unit, the more you like this culture, and the more you get invested in it. And the second time I saw the movie, I really liked just kind of spending time with the dwarves, and I feel like that was probably the biggest hurdle in making these movies, is because it's not like the Fellowship, where you have 9 inherently interesting characters. You have 13 characters who are in the book are just kind of copies of each other.
Yeah, exactly. I think part of it is that they do... It's sort of from the tradition of the Lord of the Rings movies, where they put so much thought into little design elements and just, like, embedding history into the production design that they just took a lot of effort into doing that for each of the individual dwarves, so that even though a lot of them don't, like, have lines, when you see them, you get the sense of them having this history and this character behind them.
Yes.
That hopefully, like, you know, in the upcoming movies, each dwarf will have, like, a nice little moment, so you get to know them all a little bit more.
Yeah. And I think, obviously, they do prioritize, as Tolkien did in the book, that besides Thorin, the other major dwarf in the movie is Balin. And I love Balin in this movie. Ken Stott is great. I love the beard. And he's a very sort of warm character who you feel like he's a powerful guy, but he's also a very sort of loving person.
I really like Balin in this movie. I think the other ones are Feely and Keeley feel like they have a few nice moments,
yes.
Mostly because they're the two youngest ones, so they sort of contrast... Yeah. Like Thorin and Balin, who are much older,
yes,
have sort of like been around the block.
Keeley is interesting because he doesn't have a beard,
yeah.
He's
got
archer.
A 5 o'clock shadow.
Yeah.
Like they've all kind of got a beard at the very least.
Yes, yeah. Keeley is the one who's the archer in this movie too, and I like that. I really like the weapon choices that they don't all just use axes. Thorin uses a sword. Keeley uses a bow and arrow. Dory, one of these people.
One
I don't
has a spear.
Ori uses a slingshot.
Oh yeah, Ori has a slingshot.
Ori is one of the other dwarves. I think they do a good job characterizing. He's sort of the young, stupid one, but he's got a good heart.
Yeah,
I like Ori. But my favorite dwarf in this movie is actually Beaufort, and he's sort of a middle aged one. He's got a big like fuck off mustache.
Yeah, he's got his
twirls.
like fuzzy hat that he always wears.
And he's kind of a fun-loving guy. He's the one who starts the song in the unexpected party. He's always kind of making fun. But he also, you kind of learn, has one of the strongest hearts. He really loves his companions, and he loves Bilbo.
Yeah.
And he has that great scene with Bilbo in the cave. And I hope they do more with Beaufort going forward.
Yeah, I agree.
So.
But then there's a Dwalin, where he's the first one to show up at the unexpected party.
He's
and
bald.
And that's sort of a really nice introduction to the dwarves, because he's sort of the most standoffish, like, sort of, kind of, like, gross dwarf.
He's the one you least want to just show up at your door.
Yeah, exactly, and having him be the first one to show up at the door, just kind of, it's a nice introduction into the dwarves.
Yes. So, again, a lot of these we do not get a lot of time with yet, like Gloin, who very much looks Gimli-esque.
Yeah.
And Dory and some of those, but Bomber's very funny in his fatness, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe they can do a little more with Bomber going forward. He's important sort of in Mirkwood because he gets knocked out. So they have to carry him around. I like that Oin has sort of an ear trumpet that he's always using.
Yeah.
That's kind of a fun just gag they have fun with. But again, I just like that they represent all these different ages and styles, and they've done a good job with them.
Yeah, so. They definitely makes the dwarves feel like this diverse unit, and I do like how in the unexpected party they throw in some lines of dialogue that give you this better sense of history of where these dwarves come from, that they're not necessarily these, you know, like warriors that have all this like history behind Erebor. In particular, that they're not like, you know, they're not like the vanguard of Erebor or anything like that. A lot of them are just dwarves that probably came from Erebor that, you know, that Thorin helped out and are loyal to him, but they're not like the best warriors or anything like that. They're not the smartest dwarves around.
Yes.
I thought it was a nice touch that's not really there in the book, that they give you this sense of this being this more of the sort of like ragtag, like these are like the dwarves that he could get together, but they work for him because they're so loyal and because they have so much appreciation for Thorin. And I like that touch to the movie.
Yeah, it's not a team necessarily of experts, but it's a team of people with good hearts.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Well done. What other characters are there to talk about, major characters? We hit most of them.
There's, like, Azog, I guess.
Before we get to him, I did want to talk about Andy Serkis. I know we talked about him a little bit, but there's a couple things to mention, which is, one, A, he's as good as he's ever been, but in some cases, I actually think I liked his performance even more here, because there's something dynamic about the separation between the personalities, and that he is fearsome in some parts. Like,
yeah, I mean, definitely his introduction where that one other goblin falls down to the hole too, and then Gollum drags him off, and you get that like silhouette of him just like bashing him with the rock. It's like, there's this nice menace to Gollum that isn't there that much in The Lord of the Rings. It is there in The Lord of the Rings, but it feels much more present here because Bilbo's alone. Bilbo doesn't know how to fight. He hasn't killed anybody yet.
And he has no idea what this thing is.
Yeah, so there's this nice terror to Gollum. It's like,
absolutely.
Yeah, that comes across in these scenes.
And, boy, I didn't think Gollum could look any better than he did in Lord of the Rings, But the CGI on him is so it's like he does not look fake in any way. It's like you can they can do these really extreme close-ups, and just every tiny pixel of his skin looks real.
Yeah.
And what Peter Jackson has said in interviews is that motion capture technology has come so far that they now can capture pretty much every muscle in Andy Serkis's face. And I think that's what helps the performance more than anything, is there's so much more nuance to it, especially when, you know, Bilbo takes pity on him. The way he's able to do that expression, I think that's technology having come a long way.
Yeah.
There's just so much. Andy Serkis is just there. Like, this is like a costume he's wearing.
Yeah, it's this, like, proper performance that, I agree. Even though the Gollum felt like that to me in the Lord of the Rings movies too, it definitely does feel like a step forward here.
I mean, I'm not saying any of this to say that Lord of the Rings has any shortcomings. They're great too. It's just, boy, it's like 10 years, they really took the new technology and went with it. So
still makes it really fucking weird that it's like no other movie has like a performance that's quite there. Okay, they're like all the other ones are Andy Serkis ones, really.
Yeah.
That like are at that level. Like, it's so weird that that this isn't more common at this point, that you have a digital performance of this level.
Andy Serkis can only work so much.
Yeah, exactly. It's like there's only one Andy Serkis. I don't know why there's nobody else has like stepped into that role. It's like Ray Harryhausen or like Willis O'Brien. I feel like Andy Serkis is going to like train somebody to like take his place as like this dude who does the motion capture acting from now on.
Yes.
He's Andy Serkis' successor.
Yes. So very, very good work from Andy Serkis.
Yeah.
So, I think the rest of the characters we have to talk about are pretty much CGI creations, and so I think we should transition into sort of a technical discussion of the film.
Yeah.
And I know we've been wanting to talk about this, so before we mention...
The depressing part of the movie for me.
So, before we mention sort of the cinematography and set design and all these things we very much like and want to get into, this movie has quite a bit more CGI than Lord of the Rings.
It's kind of an understatement.
Pretty much every creature who is not human or humanoid is CGI.
Yeah, there's a few exceptions. There's like
a couple of Azog's gang.
There's a couple of orcs in Azog's gang that are not, and it makes it stand out that
they're
not.
That does, because
so fucking better. They're so much better.
And I want to say up front, this may be the most technically proficient use of CGI in a movie I've ever seen. Like, it very much fits the world, but I don't like it as much as real.
Yeah, it's definitely makes the action scenes not feel as good to me. And in particular, Azog stands out.
Azog looks horrible. I don't... like. And it's funny because I say all the other CGI fits in really well. It does. It's like the trolls look like they're actually there. The Goblin King looks like he's actually there. He fits the environment. Azog does not.
Azog doesn't at all.
And there's a couple of issues here for me. One is that his design, he's a fucking cartoon. I mean, he doesn't look like he fits in this world at all. And two... why does he need to be CGI? That's my big question.
I don't know. Because he basically is just a dude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's tall, but so is Lurtz in Fellowship of the Ring.
Yeah.
And if you want him to have the pale white skin and stuff, you can do that.
Yeah.
It's just makeup.
Mm-hmm.
He's not... like, I know he's supposed to be scary. He doesn't scare me. And I think, like, Lurtz in Fellowship, for instance, he's just a big Uruk-hai, but he kind of is scary.
Yeah.
Maybe not anymore. I've seen the movie a lot, but he definitely was when I was a kid.
Yeah, but it's just the problem with CGI that no matter how good it is, it doesn't have the physical presence that it needs to have. And Azog in particular stands out. I think, one, it has a sort of uncanny valley thing because Azog's design is not that far from human. He's got, like, pointy teeth, he's got a long face, and he's got some kind of, like, weird ears. That's, like, basically it. And you could easily have done that with makeup. There's absolutely no reason you couldn't have. And just the fact that that there's just nothing physically there really stands out. And it's really disappointing because the Lord of the Rings movies managed to not do that. They managed to use so much practical effects that you didn't get that feeling. There were only a few moments where the CGI, like the little CGI elements in the Lord of the Rings movies stood out, and so much it was practical effects that let you get so much more absorbed into the movies. And having like these full characters that are CG and are not particularly well realized in CG took me out of the movie in a lot of moments.
Yeah, I agree, And again, I mean, I need to stress, it's all technically flawless for a lot of it, but it's just not as good, and it's not as good for quite a few reasons. I do think Azog is the best example because they made an odd choice to have Azog surrounded by all real people. Like, those orcs are real.
Yeah, like those, and those are the only orcs that are like Lord of the Rings style orcs.
And so when they're interacting with Azog, it's like, what's wrong with the second half of this frame? It's like, half of this frame looks great, and then you have a fucking cartoon sketchbook character yeah. over here. And it does, I hate to say this, it does kind of hurt parts of the movie, because Azog...
It definitely does to me.
Yeah, Azog should be a bigger... Azog, I like from a story standpoint, from the scripting standpoint, they did Azog very well here and how they integrate him into the movie, but I'm not interested in him, I'm not scared by him, I'm not invested in him as a villain in the slightest because he's a cartoon.
Yeah.
And it's sort of sad that we're at that point, but... And I know that's not something that's going to get better in films 2 or 3.
Yeah. And I think it's just something that's... I don't know if that's ever going to work for CG. And I don't think... Gollum is the only character... And it makes it stand out so much more just because Gollum works so well. And Azog so doesn't. And I don't know what the technical side behind that is about why Gollum looks so fucking flawless. And Azog... does not at all.
Well, and part of that is that I just don't like the design on Azog. I don't think it's an intimidating design. I don't think it's an interesting design. And Gollum has a much more compelling design. The other difference for me is that, we talked about how Lord of the Rings did practical effects. Lord of the Rings' whole approach to effects is they only use CGI when there was no practical way to do the effect.
Yeah.
So Gollum, you could not do Gollum any other way.
Yeah.
That's how Gollum needs to be done. And when we get to Smaug in movie 2, Smaug has to be CGI.
Yeah.
And we're not going to... There's no complaining about that. That's just...
Yeah.
You can't... There's no real dragons. There's no real golems. But there's no reason on heaven or earth that Azog needs to be CGI.
Yeah.
I mean, oh, he's missing an arm. You've never CGI'd an arm out before? It's not tough. I mean, I couldn't do it, but it's done all the time.
Yeah.
It's not a tough effect in the grand scheme of effects.
Yeah.
So... And does he need to be missing the arm? I mean, that's a kind of a story point, but it's kind of... this is all design choices.
Yeah.
And it's too bad. Then you get into all the stuff in the Goblin Caverns, and all the goblins are CGI. That's, we'll talk about the Goblin King in a minute, but the goblins themselves all being CGI. Well, I get for the crowd scenes, you have to use CGI, but for all the close-ups, do they have to be?
No, because they weren't in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, and so there's a weird discontinuity
Lord of the Rings, yeah.
Yeah. And even then, the one thing my mind goes to is, well, did they want to make the designs less scary because this is for kids? Well, obviously not, because then Gandalf decapitates and knocks the head off. So, whatever the choice was there, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I don't know. It is one of the more, particularly Azog is one of the more startling examples of Uncanny Valley material that I've seen in a long time, where it's like, they decided to make him look very, very human. He's not human. He's this digital facsimile, and it really stands out. And it's... I don't know why they did that. It's really startling, kind of disappointing for me.
And Azog is the worst offender, right?
Yeah, Azog, definitely. He's he never feels like he's on screen for a moment to me.
I have a question. Were you okay with the trolls being CGI?
Yeah, because those were...
How else could you do it?
Yeah, exactly.
The troll in Fellowship is CGI.
Yeah, the troll in Fellowship was in CGI. It also, having them talk makes it stand out a little bit more to me, but it wasn't like...
They integrated into the environment so well it didn't bother
me. Yeah, those being CGI didn't really bother me that much. Azog really did. The goblins really did.
Goblin King, you did not like his design.
Yeah, it's like, I think it would have been fine maybe having the Goblin King be CGI if his design didn't look so dumb. I don't know. Having him be this, really... I mean, he looked like a troll, basically. I don't know, it's sort of this weird... It feels like not a lot of thought went into making him look like a Goblin King. And that kind of was the design behind all the goblins, is that, even if they are trying to make a distinction between goblins and orcs in these movies, goblins were what in War in Moria, in Fellowship of the Ring. They were fighting goblins, those were distinct from orcs, visually at the very least. They were, basically, I would call them a subspecies of orcs if you want to kind of get into weird particulars. But you had goblins in Moria, you had orcs, which were basically everything outside of that, other than the Uruk-hai, which were big human-looking orc things. And this, the goblins don't look like the goblins did in Moria. They don't look like the orcs did in the Lord of the Rings movies. So having them be this new design feels really odd. I have no idea why they decided to do that. And then also having the Goblin King then feel like this weird. He seemed like he was a completely separate thing, because he's he's 20 feet tall, he's really fucking fat, he's really verbose and intelligent, he's got the weird chicken waddle thing on his neck. Didn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. And I kind of liked the Goblin King as a character, because I thought it was an interesting sort of choice to go with It's all you, but he's a little funny, he's a little cheeky, whatever. But I agree, he's kind of feels like he's out of a different movie.
Yeah, and it feels like the direction itself was not that bad. They just went too much in every single direction with that character, I feel like.
Yeah.
You know, making him be, you know, fat and making him be like, he's that kind of king, you know. He's not like this badass, like, chieftain-type king where he goes out on war parties. He's more of this ruler who he gets fed a lot, and that's...
It's good in theory.
Yeah, it's like, that would work well if he wasn't, like, ridiculously fat and ridiculously huge. It's like, him being intelligent would work well if he wasn't also, like, you know, this, like, foppy British gentleman type guy. It's, yeah, they just went too far in every single direction with that character. With, like, they just dialed it back, like, in every single way, it would have been fine for me.
Do you know what it felt like to me? It felt like we were stepping, whenever he felt it walked on screen, it felt like we were stepping into a Douglas Adams movie.
Yeah, that's...
Like, this
yeah.
is a Hitchhiker's Guide moment.
Yeah, that's a good comparison.
On one level, it's like, if Peter Jackson wants to make a Hitchhiker's Guide movie, let him. Give him $200 million and bring Martin Freeman back for it. But maybe not do it in The Hobbit.
Yeah, yeah, the character felt very out of place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In any case... So I think and the other moment where CGI annoyed me is that the battle in front of Moria in the flashback, it's all good in theory, and I like the story there, but man, it's
everything
digital.
Everything was just CGI, yeah. And even the battle scenes in the Misty Mountains, it felt like, because basically every single thing they were fighting was CGI, it was like, those actors are swinging at nothing. Like, you could tell that. You can't have a good sword fight with a CGI monster. That's just not going to happen because you don't have that sense of kineticism. And it
makes me a little worried for film 3 and the Battle of Five Armies because I want another battle on par with Helm's Deep or Pelennor Fields. But Helm's Deep and Pelennor Fields are great because they're mostly practical work.
Yeah,
there's a lot of, like, actors and...
Yeah, only the very, very wide shots are mostly CGI, but that works well because anything's so small so you can't tell the difference. That's
and things like Oliphants are CGI because you can't actually get elephants onto the battlefield when you're filming a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And elephants aren't that tall.
Yeah, they don't have four tusks.
Right.
I think PETA would kind of stand up if you're shooting arrows at elephants and have them, like, these giant battle harnesses on them.
That's very true. It's like... Orlando Bloom ran up an elephant.
And shot it through the top of the head.
Yes. But, yeah, it makes me a little worried. But,
yeah, this is kind of a good point because it's going to make... who knows? I mean, the CGI did improve between all the Lord of the Rings movies because, you know, the post-effects are the stuff they do last. So maybe those effects will be improved for... Two and three.
But I don't have any problem with the technical side of the effects. I just, the way they chose to implement
them. Well, I mean, I think the technical side of it is there too, because obviously with Gollum, they could make Azog work somehow. Like, if Gollum can work, Azog could work somehow. I just don't know why they... I mean, I have to just imagine that there's so much effort that would be put into it that, like, you know, having Gollum be the only fully CGI character, you have all your CGI dudes, other than the people who just, like, touch up shots and do, like, green screen type stuff, can just do Gollum, and it's kind of like what they did in this movie, where it's like, we're just gonna get Gollum really fucking good, and then we'll do some Azog stuff, too. That's kind of what it felt like. And hopefully... Because that'll be actually pretty disappointing to have, you know, a big climactic fight between Thorin and Azog, and having Azog feel like I said, you can't have a good sword fight if you don't have two swords hitting each other.
And we'll see. Maybe they can do it better. Peter Jackson usually knows what he's doing technically, and for 99% of this movie, he absolutely does.
Yeah, it's the fact that he's sort of... It felt like he was this champion of practical effects in Lord of the Rings makes this that much more disappointing that they use CGI in this way.
And I think this is a bigger discussion, too, about filmmaking at the moment, which is that people don't get that CGI is so much more expensive than practical effects. And I know that's counterintuitive and makes no sense, but using a computer is a lot more expensive than hiring actors and doing makeup and taking the time. And you know how I know that? The entire Lord of the Rings trilogy cost $280 million, all three movies together. Sean, do you know the production budget on the Hobbit trilogy?
More than that.
It is $600 million.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. And of course there was going to be some inflation for it, but it's at that level because they're using this much CGI.
Mm-hmm.
And did they need to? And did they need to spend that much money? And, you know, it's Warner Brothers money. They can do whatever the fuck they want. They're going to make every cent back and more.
Yeah.
But they're going to make it all back on this movie alone.
Yeah, this movie's made a shit ton of money already.
Yeah. And that's fine. It's just, I don't... If the money is going to this, do they need to spend the money?
No.
I don't...
No, they should. Go find the dude who made all the orc costumes for Lord of the Rings. It's like, hey man, could you make a few more of those for this one? Because
it was so well
done. It would make it, it'll like just make the practical, like, physical reality of it will make it work so much better. And two, you keep a proper continuity between the films.
Yeah.
Like, it's this weird double whammy that I have no idea why they made the decision.
And this is not even close to being on par with the problems of going from, like, Star Wars Episode 6 to Star Wars Episode 1, where everything's CGI. But it's definitely, it's a little discontinuity, and it's too bad.
Yeah.
Is how I would describe it. But other than that, I think their evocation of Middle-earth is just as good as ever.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Andrew Lesney is a phenomenal cinematographer, and Middle-earth looks really, New Zealand looks really good in this movie, and I think there's a lot of great set design. Obviously, Bag End looks as good as ever, and I like that we see more of it in this movie. You know, Matamata as Hobbiton looks really cool. There's a lot of great locations. There's a lot of cool places just along the way where I feel like those are interesting spots to be in, like some of the forests out of the Shire, and sort of that abandoned farm they find.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of good set design and things. And obviously Rivendell, there's a lot of really good cinematography in Rivendell where you've got the sun setting during the White Council scene and they're all talking, and just the way they play with light in this movie.
Yeah.
There's a lot more light. There's a lot more dynamic lighting in this film than in Lord of the Rings, and I really like it.
Yeah, I agree. I think then all the stuff in Mirkwood and Dol Guldur looked really fucking cool.
Yeah. And again, there are moments where CGI is implemented well. Like, obviously, there's some CGI in Radagast scenes, because how else would you do it? And it looks good.
Yeah, I mean, it did kind of stand out to me that the hedgehog was CGI, but
you're not really going to have Sylvester McCoy kissing a real hedgehog. He'd do it.
I don't think Sylvester McCoy would have a problem with that at all.
That's the guy we didn't talk about in our character breakdown.
Well, we talked about him.
You love Sylvester McCoy so much, I wondered if there's anything more you have to say.
He's fucking so good. I don't know. There's just
if you've never seen,
and it's the perfect character for him to play too.
It is.
Yeah.
And if you've never seen a Sylvester McCoy Doctor Who serial, he was the seventh Doctor. Find one. There's a lot of good ones.
Yeah.
And
he's Battlefield really, one is really awesome.
I love that. That's like my favorite classic Doctor Who story I've seen.
Yeah. Sylvester McCoy is just really awesome. And then also I had this really weird moment where in the scene where Sylvester McCoy and McKellen, you know, they're on screen together, that I, like, all of a sudden had this epiphany that I've seen that before, because they did a BBC King Lear adaptation where Ian McKellen was King Lear and Sylvester McCoy was the fool. I was like,
how have I not seen this? That sounds awesome.
Yeah, and, like, when they came on screen together, I was like, holy shit, I've seen this. I had this, like, and I had no idea that I had already seen them as actors together, because it was like, this is really cool that I'm seeing these two actors together and I like them so much, but they're from different things. I'm like, oh, I've already done this, and I just didn't realize it when it happened the first time.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you can find that King Lear adaptation, it's really awesome.
Awesome. So we kind of talked about the cinematography. I think the last big thing to talk about is the music. And I want to get your opinion first, because I've talked about it a little bit before, but what do you think of Howard Shore's work here?
I think it was really, really good. You know, there's a lot of recurring themes from The Lord of the Rings that are used appropriately when they come up, and then there's, in particular, I just really like the Over the Misty Mountains, like, theme song.
Yes.
Like,
it replaces the Fellowship theme.
Yeah, basically. It's like, it's the theme that they do for the Over the Misty Mountains poem from the book, and when they sing it, but then it comes in, like, as an instrumental version. It's sort of like the theme for the dwarf party that I really like.
Yes, and there's a lot of good work. I think it's, again, a very complex score. Like, if you get into studying it, Howard Shore is very smart in how he uses music with imagery in these films. And obviously you do have that basis of themes from Lord of the Rings, but he always uses them in very clever ways, where there's the obvious, you get to the Shire, you got to use the Shire theme, you get to Rivendell, you use the Rivendell theme, Galadriel has her theme. But
the
then
Ring
he,
has its theme.
Yes,
yeah.
But you always, then he goes in other directions with it.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, the Shire theme becomes the music when Bilbo runs out of Hobbiton,
mm-hmm.
and it's a really fun sort of version of this, where it's all about, it's turning the Shire theme into adventure, so he's indicating development in these themes.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of good new music, too, obviously. Like the theme you said, Thorin has his own theme, which is really good. And that's actually a significant departure from how he scored Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings has no character themes. I think Gollum has a character theme, but that's very tied into the ring themes.
Yeah.
But Thorin does have a theme here, and that's kind of interesting. But it works very well, because it also becomes sort of the Erebor theme to a certain extent. It's about longing, and it's about sort of explaining that this character has these passions that are so deep-seated, they kind of have to be expressed through the music of these moments. But it's all around very good, and he scores action as well as ever. If not better, I really like all the music in the action scenes here. It's really, it drives very well. It's very compelling to listen to on its own. If you like the music in this movie, there are two versions of the soundtrack out now, and they're both two discs. I like that they are putting out a lot more of the music initially than they did with the Lord of the Rings movies.
Yeah.
I got the special edition soundtrack. I really recommend it. It's got most of the score for the movie. There are a couple moments missing that I wish were on here, but for the most part, you get everything, and it sounds really good. And just a lot of good music in it. Radagast has a great theme that I really like. It's very Radagast's theme is more a little more experimental than anything Howard Shore has done on Lord of the Rings. It's got more different kinds of instruments, and so it's a little more earthy. But the whole movie's got a little more of a... It's a brighter score, but at the same time, I like how it expresses in many moments sort of that there's this creeping darkness. And that I feel like by the end of the Hobbit trilogy, his music will have like come full circle back to Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. So... Is there anything else to talk about with An Unexpected Journey?
Let's see. Do you know what? I have to say, when they start singing the Over the Misty Mountain song, now that I'm thinking about it, they change the last line from the first stanza. Fuck me. To seek the pale enchanted gold is the line in the book.
Yeah.
And in the movie, this one, it's like to find our lost forgotten gold or something like that. I think they change it slightly because it fits... the music that they wrote for it.
Well, that's also a verse later in the song.
I thought it was the first verse. Like,
yeah, the first verse is to seek the pale enchanted gold, but then later on it's to claim our long forgotten gold.
Yeah, but it was the first.
Yeah.
It was when they started singing the song. Yeah. And they do the first stanza and then.
Right, but they only do two stanzas from the whole thing. They do the first with a different line at the end and then the pines were roaring one. So. If they did the whole song, that scene would have gone on for half the movie.
I do love how long that fucking poem is.
Yes. So, I like that moment in the film, though. It's a nice little evocative.
But they changed the last line.
Yes.
Well.
So, final thoughts on An Unexpected Journey.
It was an unexpected journey.
So, Sean, you want to tell us why you don't like the subtitle of this movie?
It's just so generic and says absolutely nothing about the movie. This is actually something, I don't know, I was thinking about this the other day, where I got to this point where I realized subtitles are just fucking useless. Because, I mean, other than, like, they could be useful for this, in that if you had, you know, if this had a subtitle that, like, spoke to what this movie is about, like, you know, Desolation of Smaug does for the second one, and then there and back again. It's kind of like, it's a requisite subtitle. It doesn't necessarily like speak to specifically what that movie will be about. But
it's a good, you need to use it.
Yeah, you need to use it because it's basically the other title for The Hobbit. But like subtitles, you know, like there's the Splinter Cell Conviction. I have the game. I was like, it being called Splinter Cell Conviction does not help me differentiate it from Splinter Cell Chaos Theory or Pandora Tomorrow. Like... That's like, where do those games fall in? They have nothing to do with what the game's about. It's just like, or like, you know, Matrix Reloaded, Matrix Revolutions is like, or Assassin's Creed Revolutions is like, what, that's, yeah, no. Don't. Fucking dumb.
Yeah.
And this is just an example of like a subtitle that's just there because they couldn't, I guess, come up with one that's better.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because I always thought when this was just going to be two movies, I didn't know why they just didn't decide that movie one would be The Hobbit and then movie two would be There and Back Again. That seemed like the logical thing when this was two movies. For three, you obviously have to change that.
Yeah.
But they always were planning to call this An Unexpected Journey, and it's... I think they think it's more clever than it actually is.
It's not clever at all. It's...
Do you know what I mean? It's like...
Yeah.
It
does... It's weird because it feels like a subtitle that they want to title drop. Like, it does, even, like, they thankfully don't. They use the word unexpected in a way very early on in the movie that feels like it's almost like they're,
well,
like...
Well, they do. It's right when...
Yeah, because it is. It's right before the title comes up. So it's like, you know, this feels like they want to give, like, a full title, like, just awful, lame, I'm the Amazing Spider-Man type of, like, title drop, something like that. This is like, we're going on an unexpected journey. It feels like they want to say that so bad.
Or my joke about that, you know, Thorin would just embrace Bilbo at the end and say, it's been an unexpected journey, my friend.
Yeah. They don't go for the full title drop, but they get it.
When Gandalf says to Bilbo at the beginning, he says, you know, if you do come back, you won't be the same, because it will be a very unexpected journey, my friend.
Or the scene where Bilbo's running out of the Shire and someone's like, where are you going? And it's like, he says, on an adventure. He said, on an unexpected journey!
But I'm chick.
Yeah.
Oh well, I mean, it's just the title. Who cares? But it is. It's too bad because obviously the Lord of the Rings movies had really great built-in subtitles, and I think they did. They made the perfect choice for film two, especially for this trilogy.
Yeah.
Desolation of Smaug. Awesome title. Smaug. So, in any case, The other thing I kind of wanted to say is I like there's a nice touch in this movie that they have the Hobbit title card at the beginning is like the Lord of the Rings one, gold and shimmering. And then at the end, they use the exact same credit typefaces and everything.
Yeah.
Just nice sense of continuity.
Mm-hmm.
So is there anything else to say about this movie? Final thoughts?
Okay, there is one glaring, massive fucking flaw that I have not brought up yet. But that is when they go to Rivendell, no Glorfindel. None. Fucking bullshit.